don't even know what it is.
Hi, everybody. We're live.
The preface is written right there.
I know. Well, I think it could be fun.
You and I have different definitions of fun, no, I think.
No.
Unless you have some sort of bombshell
you're
trying to
drop. I was deferring to both of you. Hey, if you got a pre-show, you came up with nothing. I've got something at least.
Yeah, but it's like, isn't it administrative? That's not a pre-show.
Oh, I have a pre-show that Marco may end up dropping on the floor and may end up being just for the bootleg.
Is it administrative?
No. not really. It's sort of administrative for me and me alone. So I'm going to tell a short story about me being an idiot and somebody else saving the day. So I bought a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago, I bought a G4 Doorbell Pro from Ubiquiti. This is a, Ring style doorbell that's much fancier than Ring. And, it's not beaming your front yard to police officers all around the country, but generally speaking, same idea, right? And the way this works is, you wire it into the house, you put a mount on your siding, and then you put the doorbell on the mount. And in order to keep it secured, not from a, like, it's going to fall off perspective, but from a, keep it safe perspective, they give you a itty bitty screw that you have to put in vertically from the bottom of the doorbell. Right. And so I got a bespoke 3D printed. I haven't told the story yet, right?
I don't think so.
You have not.
Okay, good. For some reason, I just had bad deja vu, and I just wanted to make sure. So I got a bespoke 3D printed mount because my siding is, Dutch something or other. It's not that unique, but apparently it's unique enough that some gentleman's basically entire business is making 3D printed mounts for different kinds of siding. And it was
pause here for a moment. Mm-hmm. Why is the doorbell on your siding and not on the frame around your door?
Because, I don't know, that's where the original builders put it in 1998. The original doorbell, that is.
That's
so
weird.
I'm just putting it on top of where the existing doorbell was.
All right.
So anyways, much in the same way that some gentleman in Germany's entire business was renting absurdly expensive winter tires to people like Marco who are picking up their cars in the wintertime, this fellow, I don't know if it's his entire business, but his side business, if nothing else, is making occasionally bespoke, but generally speaking, just 3D printed mounts for various kinds of doorbells. Well, anyways, so I get my 3D printed mount. I mount that to the house. I mount the G4 Doorbell Pro mount to the 3D printed doodad, and I go to screw in this screw up into the bottom of the G4 doorbell. And I will give you one guess what I immediately proceeded to do.
Strip it.
Strip the screw.
No, I will give you two guesses then.
drop the screw on the ground.
Correct. Well, you get full credit, even though that's not 100% accurate. What I did was I dropped it. And we have Trex in the front. And the way our installer put the Trex down, and I don't know if this is not normal or not, but there's
a small...
I have no
idea what Trex is.
Sorry,
artificial
composite.
Deck boarding that's a composite.
Yep. Yes,
so
exactly.
Instead of it's the planks that you walk on, not like the railings usually. And mm-hmm. Long Correct. Island's full of it because it has low maintenance.
Exactly. Well, the way my installer does it, I don't know if this is normal or not, but there's, a quarter inch, so like a 1 centimeter gap between each board. And I'll be damned if that screw didn't go whee right into that gap, into the no man's land directly beneath the front porch. So I open a ticket with Ubiquiti and I say, hey, this is 100% my fault. I'll say again, this is 100% my fault, but I have dropped the little itty bitty baby screw. Can you do something about this? And expecting they would charge me an obscene amount of money for a very, very small screw. And they said, you know what? We'll look into it. Actually, here's what we'll do. I'm going to pass a message over to the warranty returns department, and maybe they'll be able to just kind of pilfer one from a warranty return, which I immediately took as screw you, go away. They said it nicely, but the real message here is screw you, go away, because there is no chance on earth that they're actually going to remember some dummy in Virginia needs that little baby screw. And I'll be damned if a week later, a obscenely oversized box, given the size of this half inch screw, but nevertheless, an obscenely oversized box came unsolicited, well, kind of unsolicited from Ubiquiti that I didn't pay them a dime for. And sure enough, in there was a little baby screw. And this time, my friends, I put a towel down beneath the doorbell before I went to screw it in. But
and then you stripped it.
And then I stripped. No, not really. It's a fair question.
Did they just send you one?
But they just sent me one, which I mean, I guess in retrospect, two would have been nicer.
But
nevertheless, this was a good tale of, you know, this is a happy support story. I was very happy that they actually followed through, because I figured once they're like, oh, yeah, we'll send it over to, you know, that other department over there, I thought there was not a snowball's chance in Hades that I was ever going to see this thing. And it was actually reasonably quickly thereafter. I was very impressed.
Well, why didn't you just go under the porch and get the screw?
Because that would have involved undoing the, I can't remember, the lattice or whatever that's down there. And I am not a handy person.
You could do one of those extendy magnet things and one of the many LED lights that you have, and see where it is and stick your little extendy magnet stick in there and stick it. Hopefully the screw is magnetic.
I don't know if I understand what you're saying. And hypothetically, that would have worked. But because it's just dirt under there, and this was a black screw and a very, very, very small one at that, I don't think there was any chance that I could have done that without actually removing the lattice work or whatever it is below the deck, or the front porch rather, and going under there. And even if I did remove the lattice work, which I was too scared and wimpy to do, the likelihood of me actually finding it, even with my go light or whatever it is that Marco recommended, which I still love, by the way, even with my fancy schmancy flashlight, I don't think I would have found it in a million years.
Why don't you just have the snake that lives under there bring it out to you?
That's true. I should have. But no, it's a happy support story, and I feel like those are very rare these days, so I just wanted to share with the class. All right, John, you had a question to start the main part of the show. What's going on?
Yeah, obviously there's going to be a lot of follow-up on this show, and I realized assembling this that the follow-up, at least from my part, is heavily influenced by which of the new operating systems announced at WWDC that I personally have been using. So I thought I would start by saying what I'm using and asking you two what you've been using. It's only been a week since WWDC. They revved all the new OSs. All the betas are out. I somewhat painfully installed macOS Tahoe on a couple of different Macs. I don't know why they make it so hard, and it just gets worse with Apple Silicon. But anyway, that griping aside, I installed Tahoe, and I've been updating all of my apps for Tahoe. They all require lots of updates, so I've just been, you know, essentially booting my Mac into Tahoe and staying there most of the time. And I have a second Mac that's also booted into Tahoe, and I've just been a lot of Tahoe stuff. I have not even installed, looked at, or touched any of the other OSs. So I want to preface that by explaining, why are you talking about macOS so much? All I've been doing is using Tahoe for the past week. What have you two been doing?
Well, hold on. Before we go there, how did you go about installing it? Because I have installed Tahoe, and I'm getting ahead of myself now, but I've only done it in a VM. I haven't put it on hardware, which honestly is kind of crappy because a lot of things are gated behind being on real hardware. But what did you do for your 1,800 installs that you've done across your 900 Macs?
Yeah, so the VM approach, lots of people are suggesting that. Oh, just install it on VM. It's real easy. I haven't even attempted that because I've seen Craig Hockenberry trying for many hours to get dev work done in a VM, and apparently that doesn't work, like, you know, developing your app in Xcode and making builds and stuff, and that's what I need to do in Tahoe. So if you just want to poke around in the OS and you don't want to mess with your system, yeah, put it in a VM. That's probably, I'm assuming, it's straightforward. I've literally never done it. You can get an IPSW from the Apple developer site for Apple Silicon Macs only, but I'm like, well, great, I am installing it on an Apple Silicon Mac. Why don't I get this IPSW? And I could not make it work. I understand the theory of how it's supposed to work with Apple Configurator and stuff, and just could not do it. I got the thing into DFU mode, had the two different Macs connected, blah, 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 never successfully did it. I started to do what I thought would be successful, and it just failed every time. So I'm like, screw this, do it the quote-unquote old-fashioned way as of 2 years ago or whenever they introduced this, which is install the currently released version of the OS, Sequoia, onto the drive that you want to put Tahoe onto. Boot into that new Sequoia install, make a new user, sign it into your developer Apple ID, which is not the same as my personal Apple ID, go to software update, say you want beta updates, and it will say, yes, you can have that because you have a developer account, and then do software update from system settings with it set to look for betas. It will find a beta, it will install the beta, and there you go. And then to add just the extra twist, whenever my Mac Pro boots Tahoe, it kernel panics on boot. Then it says press any key to continue. And you press any key, and most of the time, then it boots up successfully. Sometimes it will kernel panic again, and then you press any key, continue, and then it boots up successfully. So not reassuring, but, you know, beta one. One time, the very first time it kernel panicked on boot, I said, press any key to continue. I did. It booted into Tahoe, and it popped up a dialogue that says, we've disabled all third-party kernel extensions. I'm like, dude, this is a fresh install of the OS. No third-party kernel extensions in this Tahoe disk. But I was like, whatever, Tahoe. It's beta 1. So anyway, that's what I did, and that's how I did it.
All right, Marco, what are you running?
Betas on my main iPhone, my iPad I never use, and my travel laptop, but not my main Mac. So I'll start with the one I use the least, my iPad. I installed it and haven't opened it since. I've been doing a lot of things. On the travel laptop Mac, it's been fine. I don't use this computer very heavily. I use it like a lot. For a few minutes here and there, and then not the rest of the day usually. It's been fine on that Mac. I will say that I think the design on the Mac could use some...
We'll get to it in the follow-up,
yeah.
Don't worry.
But yeah, so it's fine. On the iPhones, this is the one I'm encountering the most because it's my main slash, you know, primary iPhone. It's been mostly okay. I have had to reboot the phone because the cell modem stopped working twice, and I've had to reboot it because it stopped being able to connect to my AirPods twice. So that's
fun.
Four reboots in a week and a half, or a week and a day or two. So not amazing. It's very hot a lot of the time. I have to like, you know, quote, force quit a lot of apps to keep it under control. I have started carrying my little ice, you know, Peltier based fan charger.
Are you regretting this or still no?
Still no. And
because you're doing dev work.
Just barely. But mostly I'm still watching sessions. Like in terms of like consuming WWDC content, I'm mostly still watching sessions, looking at documentation, doing some experiments, some test runs of like things like the transcription APIs and stuff like that. So I'm not actually doing that much development work on the phone. And I'm certainly not doing that much design work yet. However, and you'll hear me talking about this all summer, this is such a radical redesign that I think it's going to trigger a rewrite or a redesign of almost every app. This, you know, as we kind of predicted might be the case when a redesign was rumored for the system, I think it is definitely going to be the case now that I see the redesign, and more importantly, now that I've used my old app on the new OS, it looks ridiculously old immediately. So as soon as people start getting this OS, which for my users, it's already like 2% of the user base who have it, and it's only going to go up over the course of the summer. As soon as people get used to this OS, every app that is not designed for it looks old. It is like the transition to iOS 7 in that regard, that like, as soon as iOS 7 launched, when you launched an app that was built for iOS 6 and earlier with the you know, old style design, it just looked ancient. That's how this is. So I think that it's not quite as stark as that, but it's very, very close. So for me, I have no regrets living on beta 1 from the start because I have to really get used to this language and like this design language. And I have to get used to like how things feel on the system. How apps should be designed on the system, how Apple's apps are designed, what people will be used to when they use this for a while and then come to my app. Because if my app continues its current design, it will feel old by mid-September. Like, it's going to be very, very quick. Even though my phone is hot and I keep having to reboot it to maintain basic functionality, I'm very, very happy I'm using the beta full-time because... it's not a moment too soon that I'm learning this new design language and getting a good feel for it.
For me, I am running the beta on my iPad, which I use pretty much every evening as a couch computer. And I'm going to talk about that in the future in this episode. But I'm running it on the iPad. I will not put it on my phone unless I get really desperate until at least public beta 1, because that seems to be when things are at least livable. Obviously, we'll see what happens this year, but that tends to be the case. I did put it in a VM. I put Tahoe in a VM on my computer, as I mentioned earlier. I did this using VirtualBuddy, which is by a friend of the show, Guy Rambo. It's open source. It's free. It made it really easy to install, incredibly easy to install. So easy that I don't even remember how I downloaded the thing, which, yes, I know my memory, haha. But I think it was just basically I selected, I would like a 26 beta, please. And then it went and grabbed it and installed it and so on and so forth. I don't think that's terribly useful unless, like John said, you're just kicking tires.
Wait, but from the Virtual Buddy app gave you the option to do
yep,
that?
I'm pretty sure
it did. Was it just running like software update command line in the background or something?
I guess. I don't know. But I mean, I went from never having installed Virtual Buddy before to a booted VM with little to no effort in like 5 or 10 minutes. And I didn't go via any released version of the software. Like, I just said, make me a Tahoe VM, and magic happened. So Guy is incredibly good at what he does. And so this is not surprising to me whatsoever. But if you want to just kick tires, that is my recommended approach.
All you were doing with that Tahoe, is install, you just wanted to poke around and see what it's like?
Well, what I wanted to do was use the new Swift Assist, or, you know, the Copilot, if you will, stuff in Xcode. But not only does that require Apple Silicon, but it requires hardware. And so I can't do that in the VM, which is a real bummer.
And by the way, I believe it also requires you to be booted from an internal disk and not an external one. I believe that's still
really
the case. Yeah, remember we talked about that Apple Intelligence wouldn't work at all if you booted from an external disk, and I think that extends for whatever reason to the AI bay, which doesn't make any sense to me, because if you configure it to use ChatGPT, what does it care? I just saw a tweet about that. Don't quote me on that. I may be wrong, but it's something to look into. But the other thing I'm curious to know is, if you did try that, did you have the same problem that Hockenberry had, which is you can't figure out how to actually get your builds to work and sign correctly and be able to distribute to test flight from a VM?
Oh, I never went that far. I don't plan to go that far. If for that sort of work, I would likely just be doing that on my, Sequoia? I almost said Sonoma. On my Sequoia Mac and just build against new APIs. But yeah, I mean, I also put it on my Vision Pro for what it's worth. Again, we'll talk about that in the future in this episode, I believe. But short of that, the new personas are tremendous. They really do live up to the hype.
How the heck are you going to do development on a Sequoia system for the new OSs? But then I realized, oh, well, your OS runs on the phone, not on your Mac.
Yes, exactly.
Because in the Mac world, I can't really do development for Tahoe updates to my application without being booted into Tahoe. Because unfortunately, there's still no Mac simulator. There totally should be. Like, they have this whole virtualization framework, and it annoys me so much that Apple doesn't just finally, you know, figure out what needs to be done to essentially make a Mac OS simulator, because that's what we all want.
Yep. So one way or another, so iPad, yes. Phone, no. Vision, yes. Mac-ish. And I think that's it, right? I'm not forgetting anything.
All right. Well, so,
TV. No TV OS.
Yeah, none of us have done the TV stuff, and it looks like that update is not great or not that interesting anyway. But anyway, that's where we're coming from as we dive into this week's follow-up.
And one final addendum on what John just said, which he had pretty much said already. John tends to, at this point, since he doesn't have a real job anymore, do the overwhelming majority and the heavy lift on the show notes for each week. I'm the one who puts
that
together.
When I had a job too, it's not as if it's a new thing. Being like,
but it's allowed now. We allow it now, Mark. When I
you allowed
it now.
Before too.
Uh-huh. Well, anyways, the point is, what you see in the episode, I put that together, but it's entirely based on what John has done. And so, because John is the one that formulates these show notes that we're about to work this episode off of, it's going to be Mac OS heavy. And if you don't like that for some reason, blame John. And if you do like that, blame John.
And you can also blame Apple, because if I didn't have so many things to say about Mac OS, there wouldn't be that much Mac OS stuff. Just
that's also fair. All right. So let's start off with something a little more generic. And speaking of Guy Rambo, let's talk about OS 26 and version numbers. And something, I don't recall if we mentioned it on the show or not, but something that a lot of us, including Craig, were wondering was, hey, what happens when an app asks the system, what version are you? And is it going to say 19 for iOS 19, or is it going to say 26? And Guy writes, apps built before the iOS 26 SDK get 19.0 as a system version from process info. Once built with the iOS 26 SDK, the version then becomes 26.0. This is powered by the file system library core services core version compat.plist. Additionally, Howard Oakley writes at what I thought was Electric Light Company, and I just today realized is Eclectic Light Company. I don't know how I made that mistake, but here we are. Anyway, Howard Oakley writes, When built against the Mac OS 15 SDK earlier, Tahoe returns a version number of 16 for compatibility with previous numbering in all existing apps. When built against Mac OS 26 SDK, it returns 26 for forward compatibility. In scripted languages run within a shell environment, there's an environment variable to control the version number given. Set system underscore version underscore compat equals 1, and Tahoe returns 16. Leave that variable unset and it or set it to 0, and it returns 26.
This is the same approach that macOS used when they went to 11. It was 10.15, and then it was 11, but it also returned 10.16 in certain circumstances. So people were afraid that they were just going to not sync up the version numbers and just leave it as 19, which would be ridiculous. And they didn't do that. They're doing the typical thing they do, which is it really does return 26, but you get 1 year of overlap to where your old things will get 19. And I do like that they put in the stuff for like environment variables for the shell stuff on macOS. That's going the extra mile for people who care, probably for their own purposes, because they probably have a bunch of shell scripts that have code that checks the version number. So good job on Apple with the versions.
Yep, very much so. All right, let's talk Liquid Glass. Do we want to do, before we jump into what you've put in the show notes, John, do we want to do like a quick recap of where we stand on how all this looks?
I think we'll get to it when we talk about these items, because they're very... Okay. They're very generic. It will lead us to that conversation, I'm for sure.
All right. So let's start with adopting Liquid Glass. There is a WWDC session, which is very good. Or excuse me, not a session, a thing that's not the HIG. It's just a page on the website. But anyways, it reads on this page, avoid overusing Liquid Glass effects. If you apply Liquid Glass effects to a custom control, do so sparingly. Liquid Glass seeks to bring attention to the underlying content, and overusing this material in multiple custom controls can provide a subpar user experience by distracting from that content. Limit these effects to the most important functional elements in your app. And this is actually also discussed. Underscore David Smith has started a new design series. I forget what he called it. But anyways, something like that. And he's on his website talking about how he's adopting Liquid Glass and reached very similar conclusions by way of trial and error. So that tracks.
All right. So I quoted this thing in here because I'm not going to say it's not coherent. I'm going to say its coherence is not clear to me. Let me read that key sentence again. Liquid Glass seeks to bring attention to the underlying content. All right. On some level, this makes sense because there's something behind it. And by Liquid Glass showing through in a much more pronounced way than previous Frosted Glass things, it's showing through the content. Like you can see more of the edges and contours. It is more strongly showing through the content. So I can see how this sentence, you could parse it and say, okay, it seeks to bring attention to the underlying content. Setting aside the logic or the value of that, the next part of the sentence is that overusing this material in multiple custom controls can provide a subpar user experience by distracting from that content. Now, wait a second. If it brings attention to the underlying content, if that's what you're saying, that we want to bring attention to the underlying content by showing it through, but if you do it too much, it will distract from that content? I think the sentence is trying to get at is the thing that a lot of people are struggling with right now, which is, what is the value and purpose of showing the content that is behind controls? Obviously, as we'll talk about, sometimes it makes the controls hard to see. But setting aside what it does to the controls, does it draw attention to the content? I'm finding a lot of people saying, and putting posting various screenshots or whatever, saying, look at this screenshot of this app, like the whole window. And they say, the things that draw my eye the most are the floating toolbar controls, which we'll talk about later, and all the glassy controls. They're not saying their eye is drawn to the content. It's totally drawn to the shiny glass thing and the things that are floating above. So, I mean, there's lots of WWDC sessions about this, and they build these sentences that try to say, here's what we're doing with glass. But from my perspective, I don't think it is doing what they think it's doing. Like, they're always trying to say, by putting glassy controls, we're trying to draw attention to the content, and I just don't. It doesn't draw my... Does it draw your attention to the content? It draws my attention to the ugly controls. And it doesn't make me look at the content. Something that would draw my attention to the content would be if the controls were out of the way and not laying on top of the thing I'm trying to look at. What do you think?
There is no way to show me a blurry version of my content that keeps text on top of it flashing between black and white and have me think, ooh, I'm seeing more of my content, and that's what I'm
drawing
attention to.
Is it your attention to the content, or is it drawing attention to the control that's on top of your content?
No, I mean, look, this... Let's cut through all the BS. Apple likes its design because it looks cool. That's it. Just be honest. Just tell... Well, right. But it looks cool in certain contexts. It's completely unreadable in others. It's very distracting, and I think the effect is not as smooth or responsive as they have advertised. But look, that's why they're doing this. They think it looks cool, and it looks fresh and different. I wish they would just be honest about that, because you can like a design and you can put forward the design as a platform vendor because you think it looks cool. That's a good enough reason. And that's a great reason, honestly, because that is what will get people to be excited about it and to want to upgrade their phones to the new OS as soon as they possibly can, or buy new phones if they can't run it. Like, just looking cool is a good enough reason. That being said, you know, to answer the specific question, whether liquid glass draws your eye to the content, no, it definitely does not. Because I'm not aware of much content where seeing a extremely blurry version of a region of it is as good as seeing an unobstructed version of it. That's not how most content works.
I mean, maybe it's drawing your attention to your fact that some part of your content is obscured. That's what they're drawing their attention to.
There's
some of your content that you can't really see that well.
But no, like, the way most of the, you know, content extension under controls works is kind of like those TVs that light the wall behind them with colors that match what's on screen.
The bias lighting is a legitimate thing.
Well, but it's like that. It's like, well, are you seeing more of the picture? No, you're seeing some blurry light that is inspired by the colors of the picture,
which is
fine.
Bias lighting is trying to help it so that your eyes don't have to adjust so much between very dark scenes and very light scenes.
It's doing it because it looks cool. And that's the thing. And like, that's fine. If that's your reason, you can just be honest. You can say, we put forth this amazing design because we think it looks really cool. That's good enough. Like, be honest. And the problem is, when you start saying, like, things like this lets your content shine through, which is the opposite of what it does, I feel like you might start to actually believe that. And that will cause you to misuse the design or to make poor design decisions that will actually make it much harder to see content or to appreciate it or to be able to reveal all of it. And so, like, right now, like, the way the liquid glass performs right now, I think it makes no sense when you have uncontrolled scrolling colors going behind it. Because what happens is, and this is something I noticed the very, very first day of using it, it's very distracting. What happens is, if you don't know what's going behind it, and people can scroll stuff behind it, as you scroll between light and dark, I alluded to this earlier, eventually, if there's light stuff behind it, it'll make the text on top of the glass blob black. Okay. And then as you scroll, if what passes behind it crosses a certain darkness threshold, it will animate the text on the button into a dark appearance, so where the text is light, to show up against the dark background. So as you're scrolling content behind it, the button will alternate between light and dark. And every time it does that, it animates, and it's a pretty jarring transition, and it lags behind the scrolling of the content behind it by a fraction of a second, but it's noticeable. So what you see as you scroll content behind a liquid glass button is you see basically delayed flashing back and forth between light and dark of the button content. This is incredibly distracting. And so this is where it's actually doing the opposite of what they're saying. It is not letting your content shine through. It is grabbing your attention because it is flashing at you in a pretty jarring way. So
looking at the language right here, I will say that they did put the word seeks. Liquid glass seeks to bring attention to the underlying content. Fails.
Right. So
it seeks to.
Right. And so the way to use it, I'm not saying it's a total design failure. What I am saying is it shouldn't be used with arbitrary content scrolling behind it. But that's almost entirely how they're using it. So there are ways to use it. Like, for instance, like when they show the controls over a video that's playing and those controls are made of glass. Okay. Like, that's fine. You're not, you know, that's in that context, that'll work fine. If you have reasonable control over the content and you kind of know that the content behind this will consistently be like either light or dark, and so it'll be fine. It won't be doing that transition over and over again. Then that's fine too. But where you can't really responsibly use it is where you don't control the content and it might frequently go between light and dark as people are using it. And then it's just a distraction. So it's not that this can't be used well. It's that in some cases it's not being used well, but it can. And if they would just say, this is the coolest way a button can look and use it in these contexts and not in these contexts, that's fine. So I think it's going to be a learning process. Like, they really have gone over the top with this because they think it looks cool, and it does look cool in certain contexts. So there are uses for it. They just have to rein it in a little bit with exactly how and where they're using it.
Yeah, but on this topic, I think I said this last week as well. I give them a wide latitude to define a new look for differentiation purposes. That's a more boring way of to say the same thing as you're saying, oh, they like it because it looks cool. Differentiating their products so that someone knows when they're looking at an iPhone is actually an important thing that they should be doing. Like, with phones looking more and more similar, mostly because everybody copied Apple's iOS 7 thing. But anyway, it's important for every once in a while to Apple to make a big change just so when you see someone with a phone, you'll know it's an iPhone. And it's getting harder because, like, the notch is getting smaller and phones all look the same from the back and the front and everyone's got cases on them. How can I tell it's an iPhone? So I give them a lot of leeway. I understand that's an important thing for them to do. And I also understand that they think this looks good. I don't personally agree with them that much, but whatever, it's subjective, you know, it's an aesthetic thing, you either like the look or you don't. The usability problems that come with this particular choice are harder for me to forgive them for, but it is balanced by those other things. And so, and having lived with macOS 26 for the past week, I will say that at least on macOS, it's not the end of the world using it. Like, there are lots of things that I would pick apart if I was writing a review of it that have bad usability and are ugly and I don't like. And, like, I can go through the list of them. But when you're using it, it doesn't feel like, oh, I can't even use my computer anymore. It's terrible. You get used to it real fast. Like I said last week and like you just said now, it immediately makes all the old stuff look old. Like, it does all the things a redesign has to in that way. It's just a shame that there are some minor things that we will now walk through, I suppose.
Yeah.
I mean, for what it's worth, again, I'm primarily using this on iPad. I would almost go so far as to say pretty much exclusively using this on iPad because I very rarely touch this VM. And I definitely agree that it's got problems. And the flashing of, like, toolbars and stuff that Marco was describing is one of the bigger ones, for sure. I could not agree with you, Marco, that is very distracting, very disruptive, and just not dialed in yet.
And by the way, I don't think you can dial that in because you have to invert. Otherwise, it'll become unreadable. You can't have black text over on a clear button with a black background behind it. You have to invert. So what does dialing in even constitute? I think there's just no way around that other than what Marco said, which is, hey, don't let arbitrary content scroll behind floating glass stuff, which is not going to happen based on the Apple's own apps that they've designed.
One thing they could try, I mean, I'm sure they did try this, but one of the things that makes that transition so jarring, as I mentioned earlier, is that it actually happens shortly after the content under it changes. If they actually did, like, a line by line, like, if you could, if it was like halfway through the button and the top half
the
of the
top
button
half of the word
was light, like, if they actually did it, like, so it perfectly matched the content,
would that help or be even worse?
I think it would be less jarring because that, like, the way it pops in when you're scrolling quickly,
I think it, like, crossfades now. And I think the crossfade actually softens it a little bit. But anyway, like, it just...
The whole problem is that it goes slower than the content. And that is jarring because it's like you're scrolling and then it pops, you know, into its own new version. So that I think that could be made better if they really want to do that. But that's... Look, the computer industry, as mentioned last episode, has been trying to design transparent and translucent interfaces forever because they look cool in marketing shots. It's really difficult to design with that in a UI because of problems like this. It's not that it can't ever work or can work in no context. It can work in lots of contexts, and it does look cool, but it can't work in all contexts. And I think what we are seeing is, like, you know, Apple tried to do this with Safari a few years ago, too. Safari on the Mac, by the way, I think is unusable. Like, because now the tab bar,
yeah,
the entire...
We'll get to it.
Yeah, we'll get to it. Anyways, but, like, this... Having a translucent button design, again, this can work. It will work in lots of ways. Where Apple is using it now, I think it actually belongs in like 75% of the places they're actually using it.
And by the way, like on that factor, we've talked about this in many past shows, how much Apple has worked to make sort of translucent UI that works on arbitrary backgrounds. I think that they basically reached the pinnacle of usability in the previous OSs. In particular, if you look at like your current version of tvOS, the way the controls work on tvOS, on any background, pause any show with the Apple native player, any show on any frame, that like scrubber bar always looks legible and good because it is extremely frosted, let's say. Frosted, extremely smeared. There's no way you're seeing like the contours of letters or sharp edges between things. They just smear it. And they have the ability to do that in lots of places in the OS. That look, I mean, you could argue it's not really transparent. It's just kind of like accepting colors from the background. But I think they basically cracked this problem. Like the current Apple TV interface does a translucent, let's say, controls on arbitrary background without looking bad and without flashing. But it's not liquid glass. So, and it's not the new look. And so here we are.
And also, to be clear, liquid glass, people use this term to talk about multiple different things. Many people are using this term to talk about the entire UI redesign. That's not how Apple's using that term. Apple's using the term specifically about the very clear material buttons.
The part we're talking about now.
Yes, but also, there's other aspects to liquid glass. There's like the motion, the way things blob together and blob apart when buttons are added and removed from groups.
Yeah, Steve Trouton Smith has a little tidbit on that, by the way, that leads us right into the next item, which he said, it might be called liquid glass, but none of the liquid effects are present on macOS. There's no merging or morphing, no meatballs, no squash and stretch of sidebars or slider knobs. On macOS, it's just glass.
But still, like, you know, liquid glass is the term they're using for this specific style of button and all of its behaviors. Now, well, you're right. Like the previous, the kind of, you know, the outgoing administration here, there was a lot of use of heavily frosted. They called it material, but it was basically, you know, heavily frosted glass, and that makes a lot. That takes care of a lot of these design challenges because of things like, you know, you have much more control over the background contrast and vibrance of the colors, and so you don't have to like dynamically invert the colors of the text to make it legible on top of that kind of material. What I think they will probably end up doing, and I don't think this will make it for this. I think this is 26. Like, I think iOS 26, the design is effectively locked. They're not going to go back on most of this. But I think in future OSs, I think they will start to add more frosting of the glass because you don't need a ton of frosting to solve a lot of these problems very quickly. So I think that's what we're going to start seeing is like, you know, milk glass or, you know, whatever they'll call it.
Wow.
But, you know, just get a little bit of frosting in there and you solve a lot of these problems. But I think this is just going to be a really extreme year at first where, you know, we're going to see.
It's so weird that all the WWDC advertisement, like the 25 and the WWDC 25 logo was super frosted. All that glass was so frosted, but in the OS, not so frosted.
I don't know, but I feel like we got sidetracked. But for what it's worth, for what it's worth, I really do think my initial reaction is still my reaction in that it needs to be dialed in, and whether or not it can be, we've already discussed. We don't need to rehash. But I really do think it looks really good. And using it's less so on the Mac because I'm not using the Mac or I'm not using Tahoe that much. But when I go from my iPad, even to my phone running 18, it feels older. And, you know, this is what Marco had said. And it doesn't feel as new and as fresh. And I really do like the general idea that they're going for. It needs to be tweaked. The legibility ain't stellar. But I really do think this looks really, really good. And I hope and believe that over time, Apple will get a little bit of a better grip about it. Like, I've got to imagine that Control Center, which I've only seen a handful of screenshots of, but Control Center on iOS is a disaster. And I have to imagine that it's just not the final form of Control Center. You know, I have to believe that they're going to tweak that quite a bit, especially since, you know, I think that from all the guidance that I've seen on the couple of sessions I've been able to watch about this, they say, you know, never put glass over glass. Or I'm pretty sure that was said on a few different occasions that you should never put glass over glass. And Control Center is glass on top of glass on top of glass on top of glass. So,
well, it depends on what's in the background. But the main problem with Control Center is that it's a little bit too transparent. Even if you have just like a photo behind it, you see too much of it through Control Center. So they need to dial that in.
Right. So I really think we're going to end up in a good spot. I really, truly do. Now, it may suck, you know, a lot for iOS developers. And I have run Call Sheet in the simulator in 26. And it definitely needs work, but it wasn't the sort of thing that I went, ugh. You know, it's not that bad. I need to tweak it some, but I do think, with the exception of my bottom search bar, Everything else actually looks pretty good as is. And I think that's very much because I'm not using a lot of custom stuff all over the place. So I'm hopeful, and maybe I'm just ignorant, but I'm hopeful that it won't be too terribly bad. And I genuinely think, again, that this is going to end up in a real good spot come September. And if it isn't perfect, which it might not be, I think it'll be a heck of a lot better than it is now. All right, moving on with our show follow-up. Let's talk about Liquid Glass as a platform. Oh, I guess we already covered this, huh?
No, we didn't. This isn't the new items here.
All right. Liquid Glass is a platform differentiator. And Dave Wood says, it has begun. Here's a Liquid Glass clone in Flutter. And we will put a link in the show notes. And if you're wondering what's Flutter, well, Flutter is an open source framework for building beautiful, natively compiled multi-platform applications from a single code base. And this is a Google thing, right? If I'm not mistaken.
It didn't take long. Like, again, if you want to make something as a platform differentiator, let's do this thing that is, like I said in the last episode, you know, thing that is difficult for our competitors to do because they don't control the hardware software stack to the degree that Apple does. But you can bet people can try to copy it. So here you go. This is for making cross-platform apps. If you want to make one that has Liquid Glass everywhere, you could potentially use Flutter.
And then Francisco Tomalski writes, so much for Liquid Glass being one some sort of native differentiator that's going to be prohibitively difficult to copy on the web. To be clear, I don't think you should use this. It's bad enough that we're going to make native UIs look like smudged lipstick. I don't look forward to the entirety of the web looking that way, too. And then this is, I guess, a component for React, which runs a lot of websites and some native stuff called Fluid Glass, which you can use in your React.
Ready for Liquid Glass on the web. Once Apple starts a trend, everyone's going to follow it. Often poorly.
All right, let's talk about Tahoe specifically. And I'm happy to report, John Siracusa, that your dreams have come true. Whimsy is back, sort of.
Well, you know, I just wanted to point out, like, this wasn't one of the big thrusts of the new design. It's like, everything's going to be whimsical. Not really. But in macOS, there's a couple of little areas where Whimsy is still there or has been added in this case. This is a minimal nerd pointing out that the drag and drop folder animation in Tahoe is fun. When you drag something onto a folder in the Finder, it opens up and then closes and accepts your stuff. It actually changes the icon for empty folders versus full folders, I believe, where the full ones have a visible paper in it and the empty ones don't. That's fun. That's cute. I like it. And the colors on folders are nice. So I figured I would start with something nice about Tahoe.
I thought you were supposed to do all the bad things first, then you end with a nice thing so everyone feels better.
You do the sandwich. This is a very thin bread on a very
wow
poop sandwich.
Oh, wonderful. All right, well, let's talk about poop then. Let's move on to Squircle Jail. Yannick Lung writes, yes, the radius of the Squircle has changed. The default app icon size is now 64 by 64, which is nice, with a corresponding radius of 16.5. Here's the difference, and they put a little image in their tweet or whatever it was. Maybe Marco will make this chapter art, maybe not, we'll see. But you can see that the edges are just ever so slightly different.
Yeah, they're more rounded than they were before. They're pointier, and it surprisingly to me, I actually noticed this. Like, going back and forth between the OSs, the new Squircle is a little bit more baby rounded than the old one was. I think this is across all OSs. Certainly it's true on macOS, but I think it's, you know, the whole point of this design is it's the same everywhere, except for VisionOS. So there you go. It doesn't look like they changed the Squircle, but they totally did.
All right. And then in session 220, say hello to the new look of app icons. We talk a little bit more about the changed Squircle. Quoting from that session, for existing Mac icons that are similarly shaped as our rounded rectangle, they automatically get masked or extended to fit into the template while receiving the new material appearance without lifting a finger.
So this is pretty weird choice on their part. So what it means is if you've got an existing Squircle icon, which they detect somehow, because they said they will extend it into the area, so it doesn't even have to be a perfect Squircle, it just has to be roughly a Squircle. But if you have a legit exact Apple Squircle, like my hyperspace icon, they will just cut off the edges to trim off those parts so it's less pointy and more rounded. They won't put you in Squircle jail, they'll just trim off your edges. But also, apparently, if you have an icon that has like a solid color with sharp edges, they will apply a liquid glass effect to it. So there's some images here showing like a box icon, which is a blue Squircle and white letters BOX. And the new version applies chops the corners, makes them more rounded, and then applies the glass effect of the layered icons on the background of the Squircle. So it's got highlights and fuzz and everything, and also on the letters on the inside of it. This is not an icon that has changed. the same icon in the same app that existed yesterday. You install Tahoe, all of a sudden the OS changes your icon to look like this, which I think is wild. I was afraid that it was going to like start changing like my flying like hard drive spaceship on hyperspace, but no, it leaves it alone. I don't think it's messing with anything. It does add the specular highlight around my thing. But yeah, that's weird. It is a reason for, even if you have a Squircle macOS icon, it's a reason for you to make a new one with the new design. Maybe we'll talk about that in a future show or later, because there's a whole bunch having to do with icons. But just because, so you have total control over it, so the OS doesn't like try to do something smart and apply a look to your icon, because I don't think anybody wants that.
All right. And then apparently you can jailbreak your Squircle. And so as Simon Stavring writes, you can copy or paste a custom icon in the Finder to break out of Squircle jail, or you can crack open the .app package, find the .icns file, and drag it onto the icon in the get info window. And there's a video and instructions on their website that you can check out. Again, it will be in the show notes.
Yeah. So the Squircle jail we're talking about, again, is when you have an icon that Tahoe thinks is not squirkly enough, and they say, you're on to Squircle jail. So they take your icon of whatever shape it was, they shrink it, and they put it inside their own Squircle that they apply to your icon, and it looks awful because your icon is shrunken inside like this gray Squircle, depending on what's behind it, because it's really a frosted glass thing. Jailbreaking is getting your icon out of that gray Squircle that it put it in, because it looks terrible. Like, if you open your applications folder in Tahoe, you'll immediately notice, ooh, I see all the icons that are now in Squircle jail because they weren't sufficiently Squircle shaped. And what this is saying is, if you want to get those icons out of the Squircle and get them back to the way they were without, you know, the developer doing anything, you can just use a custom icon in macOS. In macOS, you can add a custom icon to essentially anything, hard drives, applications, folders, anything you want. And there's instructions for doing that we'll link. This is an opportunity for someone to make a third-party app that does that. There are multiple existing third-party apps that I can never remember the names of, sorry, that do this already, because the problem with doing a custom icon is like, well, what about when the app auto-updates or something? Now the icon is back to the what it was before. So you have to have something sort of watching in the background, watching to see your apps get updated and reapplying the custom icon. I can never remember the name of this. I use one of those things to give me a custom BB edit icon. I don't remember the name of it. There's at least two apps that do it, and I think they have them both installed. But anyway, that is your Squircle jailbreak. Because when you upgrade to Tahoe, you're going to feel sad when you look in your dock and you see what was formerly an icon that you really liked, shrunken and inside a gray Squircle jail.
All right. And then speaking of rounded corners, from session 310, build an AppKit app with the new design, and they show a toolbar window, compact toolbar window, and title bar window.
Yeah, so this, I was trying to figure this out as I was updating my Mac apps. I'm like, well, I see a lot of new Mac apps on Tahoe, and a lot of things in the demos, they have really rounded corners. But my app doesn't have really rounded corners. What's the deal there? Here's the deal, at least in Tahoe Beta 1. The corner radius of windows in macOS changes depending on whether there's a toolbar visible in the window and how big the toolbar is. Three different corner radii. There's the regular one that we see on all windows right now in Sequoia. That's if you have no toolbar. Then there's the compact toolbar window, which has a slightly more rounded one. And then there's the full-size toolbar window that has a much more rounded one. And yes, when you hide and show the toolbar in a window, it changes the corner radius of all the corners on the window. Have fun doing layout in that kind of environment. But that
gracious. Sounds fun. I'm glad I am not
like,
a
it's weird.
Developer.
Like, as if they're going to go rounded corner everywhere, shouldn't every window be like that? But they're trying to do with the whole concentricity thing and having the corner radiuses match. And it's just, it's very upsetting to me. And it's, like I said, it's a big difference. It's from the normal one at 16 point radius to the big one at 26. It's a big difference.
All right, then we've got some chunky stoplights. Avi Drissman writes, macOS 26 has chunk window control buttons. Existing apps retain their small buttons when run on 26. This is gated on the SDK that you link. When you link the macOS 26 SDK, you automatically get the chunk buttons.
I'm not sure that's right. It might just be the matter of having the toolbar visible, like I said before. This, I don't mind that much. Like, Apple has long since stopped being, like, you know, religiously consistent about the size and position of window widgets, let's say, on macOS, and I think that's fine. It's not like people are confused by what they are. It's the stoplight widgets, if they're a slightly different size. Even for a while on iTunes, they were vertical. Do you remember that insanity? like, I think this is just a connected to the toolbar visibility, which is weird, but just so people are aware, you're not seeing things. Your stoplight widgets are changing size.
All right. This apparently continues, Evie Drisman. This is courtesy of NS titled frame size of title bar buttons. Put that in the show notes. If you fiddle with window control buttons, this implementation is a good starting point for investigation.
Yeah, you could override these things and give you the big chunk buttons, even if you don't have a toolbar and do other weird things. Whether you'll get that through the Mac App Store or not is questionable, but you don't have to on the Mac. So,
hey, John, it's almost 9 o'clock. Do you know where your title bar is?
One of the side effects of the new design is that they've removed a lot of stuff. There's not a lot of lines or dividing lines between things. Things that used to be shades of gray are now white. A funny slash head-smackingly upsetting consequence of that is if you make a window in the Finder and you put that window into icon view and you just have one icon in it, it looks like a rendering error. You get a rounded rectangle that is white. Then you have the three stoplight buttons. Then you've got the icon and name of the folder, which are left aligned, which we'll get to in a second. And then you have the window content. That's it. When I look at this window, I think I should be able to drag it from anywhere because it is an undifferentiated sea of white. Like, it literally looks like the window has not finished drawing. We'll put a link in this in the show notes. It is unattractive, and it is upsetting from a usability standpoint, and I would never want to have to explain how to use a Mac by saying, oh, just grab the title bar, and that'd be like, the title what? Apple, what are you doing?
Cool. All right. The menu bar is sort of kind of missing insofar as it is translucent. Where, you know, everything old is
No, it is not translucent. It is not there.
I thought it was there.
No, it is not there. There is nothing. If you look at the dead center of the middle of your screen, you see your unadulterated desktop background. There's nothing.
Okay, yes, but there's still the bar in the upper left and all the little dinguses in the upper right.
Oh, there's words, file, edit, blah, blah, blah. Those words are there, and so is the Apple logo. And on the right, your icons are there, but those icons are on top of your desktop background. There is no menu bar. There is no line. There is no background. There is no translucent thing. There is just words and icons on your desktop background.
If, like John, you are incapable of adapting, then there are options.
I'm just telling you what it is. Like, it's not the menu bar is the bar. It's why it's called a bar. There is no more bar because you said that the bar is translucent. There is no translucent bar. There is no bar.
I don't even know where to go from here. But nevertheless, if you wanted to go back to the way it was before, to yesteryear, you can use Glass Bar by Bart Reardon. We'll put a link in the show notes. This Glass Bar app does not use a new glass material because it makes things look horrible. And there are rendering bugs when you do things like use swipe gestures to switch spaces or bring up mission control. Although that could just be a beta one problem. Bart was writing all this. And Bart continues, I'll have a new build soon and maybe I can tinker properly with glass effects and user settings.
Yeah, one problem with Glass Bar on these early versions I noticed is that when you click on a menu like File or Edit, it draws like a capsule around the menu that you've clicked on. But with at least Glass Bar, when you click on the menu, if it's drawing that capsule, you can't really see it because I don't know if it draws under the bar or something. So it's not exactly perfect, but hey, it's beta one and people are just working on these utilities. And the other one I want to mention is boring old menu bar from the Big Sur days, back when they changed the menu bar in Big Sur and people didn't like it. What if you want an opaque white menu bar? Boring old menu bar would do that for you. I'm assuming if that app is still actively developed, they'll also update it for the new OS. Third-party opportunities for people who want an opaque menu bar. And to be clear, I don't. It's fine. Like I said, it's the naked robotic menu bar. If you desperately want a opaque white menu bar, you can put a menu bar size white strip at the top of your desktop background. Done. You got it. Like, because it literally just shows your desktop background. There is no bar. So if you want a bar, just draw it on your desktop background.
Cool. You can also do boring old menu bar from the Big Sur days. Again, we'll put a link in the show notes. We are late in the episode going to talk about some of our favorite things. And if I was using Tahoe for more than a minute, I'm sure this would be one of my favorite things. And this is left aligned text in dialogues. I feel like Marco was the one of the three of us that complained most about this, but he is right to complain or was right to complain in the past because for the last year or two, maybe even
it was since Big Sur, right?
I don't recall, but for the last several years, dialogue boxes had their text center aligned, which was barbaric.
They went from landscape to portrait. So, and then also in the transition from landscape to portrait, they centered the text, which is ridiculous.
Absolutely ridiculous. But I'm happy
and not
to
just
report,
the title text, all the text. I mean, you know this if you use a Mac, but you may be wondering why it's weird and hard to read large amounts of text in these dialogues is because their portrait orientation and the text was centered.
So now it's left aligned, which I'm very excited about.
Yes.
Unfortunately, the icon is also left aligned, and it looks awful. So yeah, please,
if only
Apple.
They could maybe they could make more room by moving the icon to the left of the text.
Yeah, they could just go back. Like, here's the thing about text. Like, when they were landscape, they weren't the width of your screen, right? You can just make a landscape-oriented dialogue on macOS the optimal reading width for how long lines should be, right? And the answer is not 2 inches or whatever the hell the default is in Mac. Like, Mac screens are all wider than they are tall, unless you have your thing rotated in portrait or whatever. Maybe that's what it should do. If you have a portrait orientation screen, your thing should be... I don't... Like, just go back to the horizontal things. Like, I'm glad they left-aligned it. It is better. The left-aligned icons are terrible. I had to see it for myself, so I just centered the icon. It looks so much better with the centered icon. But yes, Marco was on the right path. You know, macOS dialogues look really good back when they were landscape and the icon was on the left, but... You know, I guess, but this is better for future Touch Macs because you make the buttons bigger by stacking them vertically and all that stuff. So I'll let them have another few years of this. At least they left aligned the text.
And then additionally, left aligned text and title bars.
This cannot stand. This is awful. This needs to be changed. Again, it looks like a rendering error. About the Finder is a great, like, it just looks bad. It's the title bar. The window widgets are on the left. You could have something on the right if you want, like a purple thing to make Steve Jobs happy for single window mode, but the title should be in the center of the title bar. It doesn't look good. It's not about tradition. Like, I don't care. Like, I'm not married to any particular thing about old classic macOS. It just looks bad.
Yeah, sure you're not.
Like, no, but look at the two things I put in the show notes here and tell me that, setting aside the awful icon, which we'll get to in a little bit, tell me it doesn't look like there's an error in this window.
Yeah, it does look bad. Because everything else in the window is centered.
Yeah, and even in like other, you know, like the dialogues or whatever, where the text is left justified, but the block of text is still centered in the window. There's still like a visible center, like the buttons are along a central axis. The left aligned titles. I don't even see how that's part of the design language. It has nothing to do with anything except for just running something that didn't have a problem. Don't like it. Hope they change. Easy to change. Easy to fix. I should really file a bug in it. And by the way, there's one thing I haven't mentioned is. I have been filing feedbacks, baby. petty feedbacks, like the Finder icon that I'm about to get to, and actual bugs, and just everything. Because, like, here's the thing. They're like, oh, well, you know, file your bugs, get them, blah, blah, blah. Like, oh, they might change it in response to feedback. But how are they going to hear that feedback? If somebody thinks that the icons in dialogue should be centered, they need, like, an official record of that. So I'm putting these dinky little official records. I hope they don't think I'm abusing the system to just say, I don't like it. Put it back in the middle. And they can ignore it or they can file it as a dupe and count it as a vote or whatever. But I want there to be official communication to say, I personally told Apple that I don't like this. They can ignore my feedback or they can count it up and see how many other people feel the same way as I do. Because they have to decide in the end which things should be tweaked. What things should we change about the design? How far should we tone back the transparency? And how are they going to do that without data? And so the feedback's of the data. So I'm doing my part, as they say in Starship Troopers, I think.
All right, so if John isn't cranky enough, let's talk Finder icons. And so if you were imagining the Finder icon, John will take offense at how I'm going to describe it, but it initially looks like a face looking at you dead on. But then you realize, oh, wait, the right-hand side of the icon is actually also the periphery or the side view of a face.
And face so and profile, yeah, you got it.
Yeah. Okay, so... apparently since forever, and I think I had known this but had never really thought about it, there were two colors on this icon, like a blue and a silvery gray, and the blue was the left hand side. Okay, how would you describe it, John?
Dark blue and lighter blue. It's not gray. Both sides are blue.
Okay, so dark blue and lighter blue. That does not look blue to me. That is the lightest blue.
Well, I mean, with the screenshot we're looking at, it's blue. You're right. If you look in the dock, it's probably closer to gray.
I don't need to fight about this, but maybe I am slightly colorblind because I am not seeing
blue. Are you looking at your Finder icon or are you looking at the thing underneath Stephen Hackett's icon?
No, I'm looking at the one on my dock. I'm looking at the one on my dock. This is almost
white. I was looking at Michael Flareup's thing, which is clearly blue, and Stephen Hackett's thing, which is blue on the right side.
Yeah, no. Okay, the ones in the Marco cut all this out because it's terrible. But since no, the ones in these images, like the flare up one, 100% is blue. 100%.
That's what I thought you were looking at.
No,
was, not,
Jesus,
okay,
no.
All right,
okay,
all right
like cut all
people,
that out.
We have figured out that we were looking at different icons.
Okay.
Do I need to start this all over? Or do you think you can get some good out of that?
Start this all over.
Oh Jesus! All right, no,
like,
no,
please
all right,
save
fair
me.
Enough.
Please
okay,
save
so,
me my editing job.
No, that's fair. That's fair. Okay, so speaking of things that'll make John upset, let's talk Finder icons. And, you know, if you imagine the Finder icon and the way it exists today is there, it, at a glance, it looks like a happy face looking directly at you. You know, you're standing right in front of that face and the left-hand side is blue. The right-hand side is like a gray, if you will. And then if you look closer at the right-hand side, you realize, oh, that's actually another face in profile. And so it's kind of two faces in one. Well, since always, the Finder icon had the left-hand side is blue and the right-hand side is like a gray-ish. And apparently in Tahoe, Apple decided it's opposite day. And so the gray is on the left-hand side and the blue is on the right-hand side. And this I find a little unnerving, but I'm not that particularly offended by it. And I think I might be the only one because especially all the old Mac nerds are very upset. So John, the king of all the old Mac nerds, tell us about it.
I mean, this is not the original Finder icon. This is the quote-unquote new Finder icon, rolled out, I believe, in macOS 7.6. Don't quote me on that. Anyway, yeah, it's new. It's not so much that I'm married to the old icon as that I think the new one is ugly. So they didn't just swap the colors. The thing that offends me the most about the new icon is the border. Like, the fact that, like, the profile thing doesn't go edge to edge, because that kind of kills the whole dividing line, like you said, like the face on face in profile, face head on. The border I hate the most. That makes it ugly to me.
Yeah.
Also, they did change the shape of like the nose and the dividing line. It's more straight than it was curved, and I think that is a downgrade. I don't think it looks as friendly and as nice. And the thing is, as Stephen Hackett pointed out, because he, you know, as he says, for kicks, I ran the current Finder icon through Apple's new Icon Composer app, and I think it looks pretty good with Liquid Glass, even with the clear and tinted modes. He just took the existing Finder icon and Liquid Glassified it. I think it fits in perfectly with their design aesthetic. Like, it already looks like a round, friendly thing with, like, panes of layer. Like, it was already right there, and they had to go and make it ugly. So I literally follow the feedback that says the new Finder icon is ugly. Change it. And the two changes I suggested making were get rid of the border and swap the colors back.
No argument. And Michael Flareup also put in his own take on it. And then a friend of the show, D. Griffin Jones, writes, I created this icon in literally 15 minutes with Pixelmator Pro and Apple's own icon composer. Apple could very easily keep the icon's historical appearance without compromising the Liquid Glass aesthetic by just flipping the color palette.
But that one's still ugly because it's got the border.
I think it's less ugly than the current one, but yes, I concur that the border does kind of ruin the whole effect. Speaking of icons, let's talk about icons next to menu items. And for context, in Tahoe, pretty much every menu item, I mean, not literally everyone, but darn near every menu item, like looking at Finder as an example, has an icon next to it, which is a very big departure from most Mac apps up until now. So Stefan Habel writes, from the using icons in menus in Apple's human interface guidelines from 2005 to 2009, quote, if you do include icons in your menus, include them only for menu items for which they add significant value. Don't include them for every menu item. A menu that includes too many icons or poorly designed ones can appear cluttered and be hard to read. Then in Apple's HIG today, quote, a menu item's label describes what it does and may include a symbol if it helps to clarify meaning.
So I thought that I'd find a stronger statement in today's HIG saying you should put icons next to most of your menus. There's a WWDC session about it where they emphasize, like, don't put one next to every menu. Like, if you have five copy options, maybe just put it next to the first one because they're all grouped together. Like, they have these weird guidelines where they're trying to say where you should put icons. But the upshot is what you just said, Casey. Way more menu items have icons next to the menu item name. So, like, if you go into the file menu now, it's like file, open, new. Open will have an icon next to it to the left of the O. New will have an icon next to it to the left of the N. Icons in menus are everywhere. And this is for platform uniformity, because my impression is that this is a more common practice on iOS and iPadOS, and now it's going to be common on the Mac. The old guidelines saying don't do this because it can appear cluttered and hard to read, I think that's kind of still true, but I think what the key point is the if it includes too many icons in parentheses or poorly designed ones, well, now we have SF symbols. And so you don't have to worry about your poorly designed icons junking up the menus, because Apple's like, just use ours. We made a bazillion of them. Surely you can find one. And if you can't, just leave it off. So the guideline is not Tahoe icons next to every single menu item. But the de facto rule seems to be Tahoe icons next to a lot of menu items. And I'm not sure where I fall down on it. It's, you know, in some ways, it's nice to have another differentiator to pick out the menu item you want so you don't have to read. Like, it's the purpose of icons. On the other hand, they are kind of small and it does look kind of busy. So I could go either way on this. I'm actually debating whether I should add icons to my menus, not that I have that many of them. Because I'm like, do I want to do that? It mostly comes down to how hard is it to conditionalize this based on the OS? Because you shouldn't have them in the old OS, but you should have them in the new one. So I'm still thinking about it. But just FYI, Apple has done a pretty, basically a 180 on icons next to menu items.
You have a lot more experience with this, both in the past and the present, but I think I like it. I think I like the icons.
Yeah, so, I mean, sometimes it does add value. They do what icons do, make you not have to read.
Yep. All right. Tahoe Tabs Contrast. Tell me about this, John.
So I noticed this in Terminal because, hey, it's just a plain window, and I make tabs in them. The tabs, I think across all the OSs, basically don't look like tabs anymore. They look like a big capsule-shaped channel with a slightly brighter capsule-shaped thing for the active tab. And I noticed this when I was running it on my M1 MacBook Air, which doesn't have, let's say, the best screen. Certainly it's not Pro Display XDR quality. And when I opened Terminal and opened a bunch of tabs, I looked at it, I realized this screen's color rendition is not good enough to differentiate between an active tab and an inactive tab. The colors are so close to each other that the screen just isn't good enough. You see a lot of this on crappy PC screens where there'll be two colors, like, you know, gray and a slightly lighter gray, that will literally look like the same gray so that you can't read the text, right? Because the display is just not good enough. It can't make that subtle difference, especially at low brightness levels. It simply can't differentiate the two colors. And I think that the M1 MacBook Air screen at whatever brightness I had it with whatever lighting was in the room could not differentiate active from inactive tab. I'm not saying hard to read. I'm saying if you put money and said, I'll give you $100 if you can tell me which tab is active, I would do no better than chance. Maybe it's because I'm old and my eyes are bad, but honestly, I was like, wait, is this broken? I looked at my Pro Display XDR. I'm like, oh, no, you can totally tell which one's active. This is an OS with insufficient contrast. I don't want to have to hit increase contrast so I can tell which tab is active. So I should probably file a bug. I think I did a file a bug on this one. And I said, basically, I have your computer. I put your OS on it. I can't see the active tab. I can see it fine in other OSs. I can see it fine on my Pro Display XDR. Up the contrast, please.
The arrow cursor has also changed.
We skipped over the other item there. The triple question mark. This is a chance for Marco to tell us what he thinks about Safari.
Okay. Apple's designers have tried multiple times in recent years to dynamically color Safari's entire top bar. So, you know, the main top title bar, the buttons around it, and the row of tabs, to dynamically color them based on the content of the website below them. They are doing it again. This is possibly the most extreme version of this attempt. And what they have in beta 1 of Tahoe is the entire top bar switches between light and dark depending on, you know, similar to the liquid glass discussion earlier, depending on the color of whatever is the topmost content of the website. So this could be like if the website has like a top black navigation strip and the rest of the page is white, black is what wins because it's on top. So the entire tab bar turns black. All the tabs, the URL bar, everything turns black. When you switch tabs or navigate to a different page with a different color scheme, the entire bar switches between black and white mode. This, to me, look, I'll be honest. I don't know how they're getting away with this. Like, that is the biggest example to me that says, like, they have no design filter whatsoever. Like, the designers have taken over. There is no editor. There is no one in charge of product who has enough power to override basic usability problems that designers are creating. If they ship this, I will switch to Chrome. It's that bad. I can't use it. It is, like, using Safari on my laptop on Tahoe, it's the most distracting, disorienting thing ever. If you ever navigate between web pages or switch between tabs, which, I don't know, I think it's a pretty common thing in a web browser. So literally, that is a deal breaker for me. If that ships, I am off Safari. And it takes a lot for me to leave Safari, but that will do it.
So the screenshot I put in the show notes is something I grabbed on my screen because I honestly, not joking, honestly was going to file this as a drawing error. Like, oh, there's lots of weird drawing errors in Toggle. This is the first beta. I'm like, oh, this is a problem. Like, it's not correctly drawing something. But no, this is not an error. This is what it's supposed to look like. If you guys can zoom in on that one, what happened is I was on the Apple developer site looking at a web page.
Ridiculous.
Right? And I scrolled the page. I scrolled the page up a little bit. And then I looked into the toolbar, and the toolbar had this region of it that was, it helps that it was like kind of like that pinkish color. If you know anything about graphics cards, you may be familiar with a particular like kind of like a magenta FOF color that indicates bad graphics things going on. I don't know if they use it as like the color of like, you know, no color. I don't know. I don't know the history behind it. But anyway, it was kind of like reddish, pinkish. I'm like, oh, there's some kind of,
I can
you
tell
know.
You. So it was mainly used. It's like pure magenta, FFOOOFF. And the reason they would use that back, you know, I don't know what they do now, but they would use that to indicate alpha transparency. Any pixel that was that color, that bright pink, would then be rendered in whatever the game engine was as transparent, because they knew that color was so ugly, you would never use it for real in a texture.
Apple, by the way, for that same purpose, use a like a beige, believe it or not, because you used to be able to set your desktop background to beige and then run a DVD and it would play on it. Anyway, so I saw this pink in the toolbar and I screenshotted it for an error, but then I looked a little closer and I saw, wait a second. If you can look above the address bar in the screenshot, can you read the text above there that says interface guideline fades out? And then can you see the text above that?
Item 2? Item 7?
Yeah, item 2 or item 7? That's part of the web page. I scrolled the web page and I said, I'm seeing the thing that I, because Marco was talking about when you first load the page, like whatever's at the top influences the bar. But as you scroll a web page, the web page's content goes up and behind the entire top bar in Safari, the tabs, the address bar, the toolbar, everything. And you see it through with a clarity that you can read text. And it looks terrible and it's stupid and does not draw my attention to the content. It looks like a mistake. It looks like an error.
Oh, it's just a mistake. Just make the
toolbar opaque. Just make it opaque. It's fine. We'll still know it's very upsetting. Anyway, there's that.
Also, so with the new design language, they have introduced two different, what they call, I believe they call them border edge effects, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea, and you'll see this all over iOS, you'll see that, you know, as you scroll content in an app that has like, you know, top or bottom bar, they will fade and blur the very top edge of the content to try to, obviously they blur your content so you can focus more on your content.
Mm-hmm.
So they blur that top edge, and there's a separate alternative rendering mode that they use, and they give the example of a Finder window that is a hard edge, which is basically a bar that is solid and has a border.
And when your content scrolls under it, you no longer see it. Like, say, a table view. When you scroll a table view, the table headers are opaque, and when you scroll the table, content goes on. It's fine. It's just I don't know why we have to print to describe a header, an opaque header. Yes.
Right. And so they have, like, they already have defined a style that fixes this problem the way we've always fixed this problem, with a solid background and a border that controls go on so we can read them.
Like, when you scroll, the whole point of a scrollable region is you can only see the portion that is within the scrollable region, and the rest of it is not, and you can't see it. But they're like, but you know, we do have more window here. And I know there's stuff in that window, like the address bar, the back button, the forward button, the window control widgets, all the tabs. But wouldn't it be great if you could see the web page through that? And the answer is no, it would not be great. Don't do that. It's bad.
All right. The arrow cursor has also been updated. There are changes everywhere, John. Changes everywhere. Mm-hmm. Nathan Manso Pano writes, this is the first time they've changed it since the Retina transition in 2018, or arguably since the first Mac OS X itself 24 years ago. Dang. And basically, they made the I don't know, the point of the arrow a little chonkier, I would say, and the post part, for lack of a better term, a little shorter. I don't know. How would you describe this, Mr. Artist?
It's like in an Illustrator program where you can say, how do you want, when the line changes direction, how do you want the end caps to be? And you can make them sharp or you can make them rounded. They made them all rounded. So the little tail is rounded. The little nubbins on the side of the arrow are rounded. The tip is less rounded than the other parts. But anyway, it's more rounded. It's more sort of friendly and rounded and baby looking.
The hand cursor as well. We have gone from the Mickey Mouse hand with, or the Mickey Mouse glove with three vertical lines on it, which I can take or leave the lines, but I liked the general shape of the hand. I even like the little indentation to let you know it's a glove. And now it's like somebody just held up a hand.
Yeah, no, the new one.
I don't
ugly.
Love it.
This is the case where the hand used to be more baby and now is more pointy and less organic looking. And I'm just assuming they changed all the cursors. I haven't looked at them all yet, but when I first saw this hand cursor, because I was actually working on one of my apps and I wanted to show the hand cursor, and I was like, wait, am I picking the wrong cursor? What the hell is that? Nope, that's what the hand looks like now. Not great, but we'll live.
Floating elements and compartmentalization. Tell me about this, please, John.
Yeah, we just talked about it a little bit, but like, you'll see it in Finder windows as well, and you'll see it in the sidebars and everything. I talked about this last week. They want controls to float over your content. This is one of the big concepts. If you watch WWDC videos, they think that basically take a window on macOS or anywhere really, but take a window on macOS. Your content owns the whole window, top to bottom, left to right. But of course you need to have controls. So those controls float on top of your content. And you may be thinking, well, if I have a sidebar, what, I don't want the sidebar covering my content. Shouldn't the content start where the sidebar ends? But they're so married to this idea that rounded corner floating things are on top of your content that owns the whole window, that they will go to ridiculous lengths to make this happen. One of the things they do, for instance, is like, say you have like a photo viewer, and of course you got on the Mac and you have a photo that fills the entire window, but you're like, well, now I want to have a sidebar in my photo viewer with a bunch of sidebar stuff in it. You're like, but I don't want the sidebar to cover the left 2 inches of my photo. Can't I just have the photo start where the sidebar ends? You can do that, but then you're not following through on Alan Dye's really strongly felt belief that your content should be behind the sidebar. So they say, how about we do this for you? How about we do the equivalent of a scroll edge effect, but instead of just blurring the edge of your photo, what we'll do is we will mirror your photo to the left under the sidebar and then blur the mirrored portion. You see this sometimes when they take like you have a 16:9 window, but you're watching a 4:3 video, and they mirror and blur the edges of the 4:3 to fill out the 16:9. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
Like that's essentially what they're doing with your content. And it's really weird and distracting because you're like, wait a second, is there some portion of my photo that I can't see to the left? The answer is no. It is just a blurred, flipped version of it. And its sole purpose is to make it look like your content goes all the way to the left edge, but it does not, because that would be insanity. And so now you can see the little edge of your content around the top left and bottom of the sidebar, and also, of course, through the sidebar, because why wouldn't you want to see your mirrored, flipped, blurred content showing through your sidebar, making it less legible? And that continues up to toolbars. Toolbars look like a bunch of lozenges that are floating with huge drop shadows on top of your content. So in a Finder window, your content are like the icons of your items or list view or whatever. But you've got this toolbar with no dividing line, with just a bunch of floating things on top of it. And I believe it has the edge effect, like Marco said, the hard edge effect in it. And then the sidebar, which is inset, so you've got this border so it can show that it's floating. They're so married to this. And like, I see some value of like content, but then there's a control layer above it in 3D space with shadows, but their implementation of it sacrifices a lot of utility and readability for this metaphor that I feel like is not necessary. Like, I don't think there was anything particularly wrong with the idea that is a toolbar on top, a sidebar on left, a bottom bar on the bottom, and they framed your content, but they were all in the same plane and your content didn't go under them. But Apple says no, content goes under everything, and so we all float down here.
If that's a reference, I got nothing.
Sure is.
Of course it is. Mario Alberto Guzman writes, when you try to create user interfaces where you don't have distinct and hard separations for compartmentalization, you end up with weird junk like this. Notice how the horizontal scroll bar is above the now playing controls. This is, again, one of those things you just need to see to believe. I will tell you one more time, I think that this whole new design system in Liquid Glass, I think it's going to work. I really do. But wow, this is bad. Particularly that scroll bar is not good.
This is Apple's music app, by the way. This is not a third-party app. This is Apple's music app, and they've decided that the controls should be on the bottom in a floating lozenge. But, of course, if the content area scrolls horizontally, where are you going to put the scroll bar? They put it on top of it because they want to show the content going underneath the scrolling thing. I bet they can fix this just by not ever allowing it to have a horizontal scroll bar, but it is kind of a table view because that's how music works.
Or just put the scroll bar below the lozenge, right? What's wrong with that?
Maybe, but like, how would you manipulate that? And would you have to leave, like, would it be on top of the lozenge? They're very insistent that the controls float on top of everything. So like, but how, especially if it's one of those scroll thumbs that appears and disappears. The Apple's made these problems themselves. I want to see how they solve them. But like, they're problems of their own invention. Like, there was nothing wrong with the idea of a opaque toolbar or sidebar or bottom bar.
Steve John Smith writes, Liquid Glass tells us to put a bunch of stuff in a glass layer above the app, but it doesn't tell us why. Why are the window traffic lights housed in the sidebar on macOS, for example, or on top of the sidebar on iPad, or in line with the window content for apps without a sidebar? It's very fickle.
Yeah, so like I said, I think it's still clear what the, no one's confused about what the window widgets are, but layering wise, it's not coherent at all. Like, are they, should they be floating on top or should they not be? Should they be part of the window or should they be part of the sidebar? Like, as someone pointed out, it's almost like the close widgets are saying, hit this red button to close the sidebar, because they're so clearly part of the sidebar, unless they're not and they're in the window. It's, I don't think it's that confusing, but like, it's, first of all, it's, I don't see the benefit in these five different modes. Like, I say, maybe the iPad should look different than the Mac, whatever. Like, I'll allow it to do that. But even within the Mac, I don't think the sidebar should be a thing that floats on top of stuff. Lots of people would do alternate designs of like, how about we just end the window there and have the sidebar come out of the window kind of like a drawer and a real throwback. And people did mock-ups of that. It looked pretty cool. But yeah, like this, I'm not going to say their idea of controls float on top of your content is a bad idea, because it's not inherently bad, but it causes a lot of problems for them that they have not shown that they have solutions for, even in their own apps, which is not encouraging.
Yeah, because it's, again, like, these are all, like, you can make a design language that is full of transparency and shadows and edge-to-edge content and all that, but those are hard to design around, and they haven't, largely. Like, they've just been like, all right, we're just going to do this. Okay, that's not a great design in every case. It takes some work. It takes some self-control. It's going to take a lot of revision.
And it takes redesigning apps that they haven't touched in forever. So now guess what, Apple? You have to go and touch those apps, unless they're just going to be embarrassing if you don't.
And they don't seem to either agree or care. Because, yes,
well,
they will
just
be embarrassing.
It's beta one. I'll give them some time to update their apps. But, like, you know, it's going to be – because as you get farther away from the beaten path of, like, the apps that Apple ships – you can just assume they're not going to get touched and they're just going to look how they look.
Yeah.
All right. I think we talked last week, at least briefly, about multiple clipboards and clipboard managers and things like that in macOS. And a friend of the show, Stephen Robles, writes, clipboard history is on an 8-hour cycle, so there's no way to keep the past 100 clippings like in PasteBot. After 8 hours, a clipping is removed, and you can find more in one of Steven's many videos, but specifically one about this. So,
yeah, I mean, there's still definitely a place for third-party clipboard managers. I was forcing myself to use the Tahoe clipboard manager instead of installing PasteBot, and I was shocked, maybe I shouldn't have been shocked, that their 8-hour cycle and the number of clippings they save is way too low for my use. Very often I would go in there and be like, that's it? That's all? Where did my... Oh, 8-hour cycle. I guess that was yesterday. My clipboard history and I forget what I have it set to. I think I have it maybe 500 or 1,000. Setting aside how much more efficient the keyboard shortcuts are for PasteBot, like, again, I love that it is built in, and I will use it on everybody else's Mac once it gets activated, but I'm definitely still going to use PasteBot. But be aware, Apple, I mean, I'm assuming for privacy reasons, is being very conservative for their implementation. It is simple. It is, as far as I know, unadjustable unless there's a plist thing. After 8 hours, things are gone. And I think the list is like 20 to 50 items or something. It's very limited, which I think is reasonable.
Rosetta is the, or I guess Rosetta 2, strictly speaking, is the mechanism by which you can run something compiled for Intel on Apple Silicon. And Ars Technica has an article about the future of Rosetta, and it reads, in part, macOS Tahoe will be the last new macOS release to support any Intel Macs. All new releases starting with macOS 27 will require an Apple Silicon Mac. Apple will provide additional security updates for Tahoe until fall 2028, 2 years after it is replaced with macOS 27. Apple is also planning changes to Rosetta 2, the Intel 2 ARM app translation technology created to ease the transition between the Intel and Apple Silicon eras. Rosetta will continue to work as a general purpose app translation tool in both macOS 26 and macOS 27. But after macOS 27, Rosetta will be pared back and will only be available to a limited subset of apps, specifically older games that rely on Intel-specific libraries but are no longer being actively maintained by their developers.
Well, look at this. Apple giving more roadmaps. This is like a 3-year roadmap, and unfortunately, this roadmap news is not great. What they're saying is, so forget about Intel Macs, all right? So they're into the dustbin of history, right? You have an Apple Silicon Mac, right? But what if you still have some x86 executable somewhere on your Mac? And you might not even know that it's x86 because it just runs so fine. Rosetta is beautiful and fast and transparent, and Apple Silicon Macs are fast. You probably don't even know that one of the apps that you use every day is actually not natively compiled for Apple Silicon. What they're saying is that after macOS 26, that app might not launch, but not because they'll be removing Rosetta from macOS. It will still be there, but it will only be for specific older games that use Intel that the developer's never going to update. But like, is this some kind of like special list? Can you get your app on the list? It's like, I don't feel like updating my app. I'm never going to update it for Apple Silicon, but people still like playing my game. Can I get on the include list that says, oh yeah, Rosetta will run with you? Like, I don't really understand the idea of sunsetting Rosetta. Just leave it there. Leave it there forever. Is it that big or that cumbersome? Like, do they think that removing Rosetta is what it takes to get people to update for Apple Silicon? Look, if people haven't updated their apps for Apple Silicon by now, they're never going to do it. Any app. So just leave Rosetta there for those apps and, like, I don't know, remove it 10 years from now or something. Like, it doesn't have to be there forever, but this seems like a short horizon. And again, this affects Apple Silicon Macs. Does not affect Intel Macs. This is all about Apple Silicon Macs that are currently running things that are x86. I just thought of it today when I installed like a command line tool and I didn't want to bother building it, so I just downloaded a binary because it was just one file, right? And I downloaded the things they offered. They offered an x86 download and an ARM download, and of course I'm on my Intel Mac Pro, so I downloaded the x86 download, and I realized, oh, I have to remember that that one command line tool is x86, because in macOS 27 it will stop running. I'll have to go back and re-download the ARM version of it. This seems really weird to me, and the exception for games seems even weirder. So we'll see if this changes before macOS 27, but be aware, this is a thing.
A new thing is a new disk image format, ASIF, or Apple Sparse Image Format. These files transfer more efficiently between hosts or disks because their intrinsic structure doesn't depend on the host file system's capabilities. The size of an ASIF file takes on in the file system is proportional to the actual data stored in the disk image, which is pretty neat. And from the aforementioned Eclectic Light company, there's a whole write-up about this. ASIF images are sparse files in APFS and are flagged as such. John, what is a sparse file?
That's like if you wanted to make like a 100-gigabyte file, but you put one letter in it, it wouldn't take 100 gigs on disk. It would take one letter. But if you looked at the file size, it would be like, oh, yeah, this is totally a 100-gig file. But if you counted the contents, it would show you 100 gigs of like zeros plus that one little letter you put in there. But in the file system, it's a sparse file. You don't need to populate all that empty space. You just need to put in the data that's there. Sparse files are a very common feature in most file systems, and APFS has it. I think maybe HFS Plus did too, but I don't quote me on that. But anyway, yeah, that's... So the thing with disk images is always like, oh, I'm going to make a file on disk that, like, when you double-click it, it mounts as a volume. But you always start those things off if you make a new one. They start as empty. And one way to do it is, okay, you make a 500-meg disk image, I put a 500-meg file on your disk. But sparse files let you say, well, why don't we just make that take up no space because there's nothing in it yet? And there are various approaches to doing that with, like, okay, well, this actually could be a directory with a bunch of little stripe files that are, like, parts of the disk. So as you write data to the disk, we write more and more of those files, and each one of those files is, like, 16 megs or something. So it's a directory full of 16-meg files, and as you fill the disk, more 16-meg files fill up. And there's been so many different disk image formats across the history of Apple's OSs. I just had occasion to find some old ones because I was getting some old WWDC stuff, and they were disk images that would no longer mount on modern Mac OS without some, you know, downloading some command line tools to make it happen. But there are so many of them, and it's always like the question, oh, if I want to make a disk image, is it a read-write disk image? Is it a sparse bundle? Is it, like, I don't know which disk image format to use. ASIF looks like it might solve that dilemma because, based on Howard Oakley's testing here, ASIF is the fastest disk image format. It is the newest one, and it also uses sparse files, so it won't take up a lot of room. So, assuming this works well, the answer to the question of what disk image format should I use if I only care about modern Macs and forward is ASIF. I haven't tried it myself, but I'm excited.
Do we want to talk about performance specifically, or do you just
it's the best one. You can follow the link and see the stats on it. It's not tremendously faster, but it's nice that, like, you don't have to guess which one. Oh, well, you want this one for performance, this one for size, and this one for compatibility. I mean, I guess you still have the compatibility concern, but, you know, if you just want it for now forward, ASIF.
Use ASIF whenever possible. iOS 26, Marco, since you're the only one really running it, any other UI impressions you would like to share at this time?
Oh, it's buggy as hell. I mean, if we were just talking about performance a second ago, I know that was a different context, but this is on an iPhone 16 Pro, the fastest iPhone Apple currently makes. It's incredibly slow and incredibly buggy. There's animation bugs everywhere. There's rendering bugs everywhere. All of the new APIs for, like, tab bars and searchable and all that other stuff, super buggy. Like, bad animations, missing bad geometry. There's a lot of work to do here. So I'm on level, it's developer beta 1. This is, like, hopefully the roughest build we will ever see of this OS, but it really has a lot of baking left to do. And I don't know how Apple's going to do it in time. I really don't. Like, this was a huge undertaking. You know, allegedly they've been working on this redesign across the systems for years. They could not have shipped it before this year. I don't even know that they could ship it this year, but they're going to. It's really rough. And every animation is janky and sluggish. None of them are smooth. None of them are fluid. It's not liquid glass. It's, like, you know, stuttery glass. Like, it's nothing is running at 60 frames a second. Like, it's, or yet alone 120, which is what they're supposed to run at. It's a very early, rough build. That being said, regarding your actual question of the design, one other big issue I keep running into, besides the, you know, blurring and blobbing of everything, is they have used the ellipsis / meatball / what they're now calling a more menu or a more button everywhere. In ways, in contexts that they don't necessarily need to. So there's two contexts that keep bugging me. One is in Safari, and I did learn that you can change the Safari toolbar back to kind of an older version, but that has other kind of downsides to it. But in Safari, to add a new tab or close the current tab is now an additional tap than as was before in the default layout. You have to first tap the ... more menu, first tap that, then in the menu that pops up, you got to then tap the, you know, new tab or close tab or whatever there, or the all tabs to go back to the tab view. So that's one. You can actually, which I learned when I complained to Mastodon about this, you can actually swipe up on the Safari address bar area, and that will get it into the all tabs view. But the problem is, you also swipe up in a very close region of that to change apps and go back to the home screen. And I have tried for the last few days, I've been trying to get myself used to that gesture to try to keep the new layout of Safari and just get used to pulling up to go to the all tabs view. And my hit rate is not good. I keep accidentally triggering the home gesture of the phone. That's not a good gesture. It's like, that is a terrible gesture. And yes, you can also swipe left and right on the address bar to switch tabs left and right, which I also didn't know. But
you didn't know that? I've been using that for years. Like, that Well, when they first put the bar on the bottom, that's when they added that.
Yeah. Anyway, to rely on the up swipe gesture for going to the all tabs view, which is a very, very common action that I do, I don't love that. The new tab gesture or flow is also weird. In Mail, what I'm finding...
Before you move on, you should point out that you can actually change it so you don't have to do that swipe.
Yeah.
And it will permanently put the... It'll basically put a little bar under the address bar that has the button for all tabs you just like it does now.
Yeah, so if you go to the Safari settings, right. You can change the bottom toolbar to bottom mode or something instead of compact mode or something like that. And it puts back... basically the old bar, but everything's harder to hit because it's all pulled in more from the edges, so the toolbar items are all closer together.
This is really important for you to see a little bit of your blurry web page around all the edges, and also to have those bars block the bottom content on the web page.
Right, and also let's make all the tap targets for these very commonly used buttons smaller and move them a little bit from where they've been for years.
Everything's got to be... That's another thing, by the way. These rounded corners everywhere make the safe area insets narrower, because if you have rectilinear content, it's got to avoid that whole curve, because otherwise the corner will be clipped. So everything has to move up and in from all sides, and that's why the tap targets are smaller. And by the way, of course, that whole rounded corner thing is floating with a margin around it, so there's less room. But just to be clear, what you were trying to do is get used to that gesture to use the new UI. You may eventually give up and go to settings and change it back to something that's closer to the old one, but still has smaller tap targets.
Yeah, so either way, your muscle memory is broken, and it's not fun for such a commonly used app. And then Mail, both Mail and Music, I these are very commonly used apps for me. So in Mail, many of the common actions that used to be buttons in the toolbar, including Select, a very common action, that's now under the ... menu in the upper right. Now, what they did was collapse, two or three buttons that used to be in the upper right into a ... menu. But why? What were they making room for? Nothing. What's up there now is nothing.
A blurry version of your content, I believe.
Yeah, and when you scroll down, it becomes like the blurry navigation bar. There's still room there for two or three more toolbar buttons in the upper right. So they broke the muscle memory. They added one more tap to a bunch of common actions. Why? To make room for what? Nothing. So also in the Music app, when you go to the album view the album view music, usually there's a little icon in the upper right that tells you, it's the plus if it isn't added to your library. It's a check mark if it's downloaded. Those are useful things to know on your iPhone when you might not be online all the time. And in the new Music app, that's gone. That other button is just gone. Everything is now in the ... menu on that album view. They did that to make room for nothing. Literally nothing is up there. where Alan Dye's designs go the most wrong is burying things into menus and junk drawers of various sorts for no real benefit. This is just minimalism for minimalism's sake.
It's like a minimalist desk where there's nothing on the desk, so you can't actually get any work done because there's literally nothing on it. If you need a pen, a pencil, a mug, everything would be inside drawers tucked away so you can't see it because you want the desk to just have nothing on it.
Right.
And that's not useful.
Right. It's fun to look at, but that's not how you design tools. And the reality is, all of these UIs we're talking about, these are tools. Like, our phones are tools. The apps that we use on them are tools. They have function. And as much as Apple's design talks about getting out of the way of your content, well, what you're taking out of the way is functionality. So it has to be for a really good reason. Now, the best possible reason to take away the controls, you can see it when you're playing a video. You want to play a full screen video. Okay, have the controls fade out the way we've done since the iPhone 1. That's great. There's a huge reason for that. In that context, it makes sense. But in every other app, you got to make that decision. You can't apply the same design, decree to everything of hide as many controls as possible. But that's what they're doing. They are hiding as much as they can in the name of, quote, content. But these devices are not just to view content. They are to interact with things. They are to make things. They are to perform functions. And I feel like the dogma of minimalism in Apple design is a little too far. And Apple has always been further than ideal in that, on that spectrum of normal tools that are visible to everything and ultra minimalist, totally unusable. Apple's always been closer to the totally unusable end of that spectrum. But they have taken an even bigger step in that direction. in the same way that, like, I think unedited Johnny Ive just made everything as thin as possible, even at the expense of functionality, I think unedited Alan Dye just hides everything behind menus, modes, and drawers of various sorts. It's just, everything is hidden. And it's not like, it makes sense to hide behind a menu controls that literally cannot possibly fit any other way, and ideally, you know, things that are not used that frequently. But that's not the case for these controls. That, like, there is room for the things they've taken away. They've taken them away and replaced them with nothing. But we didn't need that space to view a blurrier version of one male title. Like, we didn't need that. We need that space because the reason we're in mail is to operate on our mail. And we need buttons to quickly operate on the mail. The icon that they got rid of in the music album view served a purpose and was also a button to change that purpose. So if you wanted to download everything, you could download everything with that one button. Now it's under a menu. You want to see if this is in your library? You got to look. You got to check. You want to see if everything's downloaded? You got to scroll down and see are the little check marks next to every one of these songs in this album? That's just loss of functionality. And for what? Nothing. They literally replaced it with nothing. They are decontenting the interface for superficial design screenshot reasons, I guess. But they're literally taking away functionality from our computers. For what? There has to be a good reason, and they don't have one. They're just doing it for minimalism's sake, and that's bad design.
The sad thing is they had various times in their history, in recent history, pretty good solutions to this. Like, you know, one of the things you're not saying is that, like, setting aside how hidden or revealed buttons are and how many functions you have to dig for, there's also the question of, and you kind of alluded to a little bit of, like, well, which things are used frequently, which are obscure? Like, this, the people, you know, you archive messages all the time. For me, the main thing I do in my mail application is mark things as junk. So it drives me bananas that in Apple Mail on the phone, there's not a file as junk toolbar button visible at the top or whatever. But anyway, that you can, as a designer of application, you can say, these are probably the things people are going to do more frequently, and these are the things they're going to do less frequently, and so if I have to bury something, I'll bury the less frequent ones. But the thing is, you don't know what everybody wants. So a good design would be, we come up with what we think is a nice balance between beauty, minimalism, and the functions we think most people are going to use. And then we allow the user to customize it, because maybe if there's only room for one or two buttons at the top of their phone screen, we can pick what we think that most people will want, but if they don't like those one or two buttons, they can customize it. Can you imagine a customizable toolbar where you could decide what appears in it in what order, and you could arrange things into sections, and you could decide whether you see icon or text or both? They had that on macOS anyway, and they could have something like that with the new design language across all their platforms. A customizable, configurable toolbar that they pick the defaults for, and that if you don't like them, and you want that little widget back in music, you should be able to get it back. And if you don't care about this stuff, you just take whatever they give you, fine. It doesn't add any burden to the average user who's just going to take whatever interface Apple wants. But imagine if, A, they would make smarter choices about the defaults, which, by the way, when they had configurable toolbars, they would often give you a whole default thing. So if you mess it up real bad, you could always just say, just go back to the default one that Apple said because I messed mine up. And B, that you can make it work exactly how you want, because a really good tool is not just designed well out of the box, but also allows you to tune it for your purposes. If the main thing you do with your mail is archive, or the main thing you do is file things into one or three folders or something, you could have buttons visible. Like, you choose how to use that precious space at the top of the mail thing on your phone for the things that you do most frequently. And instead, we get no options, no configurability, and Apple's choices are hide everything away. It's like if you got into a new car and the steering wheel was shrunken and hidden inside the glove box.
Right, and
like,
for
see, the steering wheel is out of your way. So when you want to steer, just open the glove box, lean over there, and turn the little wheel. But isn't it great how the dashboard is so uncluttered when you get in the car? It's like, I have to steer. What do you think I opened the car for? I'm going to steer it.
We've cleared away all this junk to make more space for your view of the road.
Right. And if
and the wall you're
when
crashing
you need to steer,
into,
Just go to the touch screen, find the button that opens the glove box, reach in, find the little wheel, and turn it. And that's when you want to make a turn, that's what you do. But the rest of the time, the steering wheel stays out of your way.
Right. Like, this, I feel like the design has gone too far. And I know this is like the constant Apple critique over time. They've gone too far for form over function. And as I said at the beginning of the episode, I think it's very important for Apple to keep updating their designs to look cool over time. That's very important. And as I said, even if the only reason to do something is like to change the system theme is it looks cool, that's a good enough reason. They have to do that over time to stay cool and trendy and fresh and relevant. I get that. That is not mutually exclusive with usability and legibility of text and performance. And like, you can do all, you can have all of that. A good design is beautiful without having to turn on a bunch of accessibility options that you don't otherwise need. A good design has legible text without having to say, well, you got to change it for this content, but it's going to fade and flash for this content. And a good design for a computer application gives you the controls you need right at hand for easy, frequent access. And this design that they have across the system can do all of those things. It is not incompatible with those goals. They just aren't doing it in a lot of cases. So I do think that we need to keep pushing on this, because we're not saying revert the whole thing back, this sucks. We're not saying that. What we're saying is, okay, this is interesting. It looks pretty cool in some places. You've made some really bad decisions in other places. Let's revert those. And here's why that button you got rid of, you've actually made this worse. Here's why this super clear view on top of this text is not actually helpful and is actually causing problems. Like, we have to tell them that. And as I said earlier, too, I don't actually think most of this is going to change for this release cycle. I think most of what we see today is being released. Hopefully, they'll fix most of the many animation and rendering bugs that are all across the systems. I hope, because there really are a lot and they're really bad. But in the meantime, design-wise, like, we need to critique this, because what they have done is a lot of cool stuff and a lot of bad stuff for no good reason. And the bad stuff for no good reason, for the most part, is actually really easy to fix. And they could do it in one beta. Like, in one beta build, they could fix a lot of these things.
Yeah, and maybe they will. We'll see. This kind of reminds me of, like, you know, I'm always following Destiny and Bungie. And, like, in the gaming community, it's, if you think we complain about Apple too much, oh, my, like, people who are ostensibly gamers and fans of games and game companies, all they do online is complain about the companies and what they're doing. And no matter what those companies do, they're like, you know, you're not listening to us, we're your players, blah, blah, blah. Those game companies, Jump Bungie in particular, react so quickly to this kind of feedback, it would make Apple's head spin. To give just one example, I was thinking about it for buttons. Like, you're like, if you could just say, like, you took away all the buttons, you put them in the dot dot menu, like, bring back one or two, or let me pick what those one or two are. Do it in settings if you don't have it. Like, imagine if instead Apple said, hey, in the upcoming version of Mail in iOS 26, they said, like, 3 months ago, we're thinking of having just a dot dot menu at the top. And then people in the community complain. They said, that's bad. Why use the buttons that are up there? Don't put everything in a dot-dot menu. And then 3 weeks later, Apple said, okay, we've heard your feedback. We're not going to put everything in the dot-dot menu, or we'll put the buttons back. This is before the thing is released. That happens to Bungie all the time. And people are so mad about it. They're like, oh, Bungie said they're going to take away one or two fragments from the Prismatic Warlock, and we think they shouldn't do it. They're talking about something that's going to happen 3 months from now. And they're mad because Bungie told them they're going to do it. And they complained about it. And then Bungie said, like, a week later, yeah, we're not doing that. We're still going to take away some, but we're not going to take away all the ones that we said before. And then they're going to see what the feedback for that is. And people are so mad at game companies because, like, they don't listen to us and they're so evil. And I'm like, imagine Apple. They don't tell us what they're going to do. When they do it, it's obviously wrong and bad. And we complain about it. And we're just resigned to the fact that we're going to have to use it until someone changes. Anyway, follow up next week if they change this. But some things are easy to change, like this one. Hey, don't put everything in the dot dot. You have plenty of room. Put stuff up there. Some things are harder to change, like a configurable toolbar system or settings or whatever. Some things may be impossible to change, where if you want it to be glass and stuff shows through, it's going to have to flash, but we'll see how they do. Oh, no, the one control that I wanted to highlight from iOS 26, which, you know, these controls are more or less the same everywhere for consistency, but anyway, sliders. Like, when you have a volume slider or a brightness slider, not the ones in Control Center, but, like, the slider control, which has essentially a track and then a thumb in the track that you move along the track, that has looked many different ways over the course of, starting with Mac OS X, even before that. There's lots of different looks for that thing. The look they have for it in the new design is so clearly touch focused because the thumb or whatever that you move in the track is very big by macOS standards. It makes sense as a touch target that it would be roughly that big, but it looks cumbersome and ugly, I think, on macOS. But anyway, setting that aside, in iOS, like many of the controls throughout the new design, when you grab the little thumb in the track, it turns into liquid glass, as in it becomes transparent. So you're like dragging a water blob, and then it becomes more solid slash frosty when you let go, I think. But anyway, what this means is that you can see in the track, like the sort of like thermometer bar filling as you slide from like low brightness to high brightness. Some part of the track is filled with the blue color and some part of the track is not. And as you slide the slider, more of the track gets filled. And Nikki Tonsky points out, I always imagine that it's the center of the thumb that points to the slider position. Mm-hmm. Turns out Apple has a different idea. So what he's saying is like that little thumb, if you've been envisioning before it was made of water, if you've been envisioning like, okay, wherever I drag this thumb on the slider, the center of the thumb is where the setting is. But if you do this on iOS, what you'll see if you move your finger out of the way, because your finger would be covering this most of the time, is that when the slider is on the left, the blue bar is to the left of the thumb. And when the slider is on the right, the blue bar is to the right of the thumb. Only when the slider is dead in the middle is the blue bar in the middle of the thumb, which is weird, but a sort of natural consequence of the design they've chosen for how these sliders work and the fact that you can see through them. I don't think it's a functional problem or an interface problem. It's just weird.
Well, this is like when you look at the actual like design of such a thing, like metrics wise, this is how it has to work. Like otherwise the track wouldn't fill the width. Like if the center of the scrubber was the value, then when you like, if it's at the far left, then the scrubber would be off the left edge of the track.
Well, it's only the way it has to work with this scrubber, because this scrubber is very wide. If like macOS scrubbers used to be very thin, so you didn't have to do that. So really, what you basically need is I need 50% of the scrubber to be off the edge of the track, and with a narrow scrubber, you can easily do that. Or with a scrubber like the macOS ones used to come to a point at the bottom. Like, anyway, you just need half the scrubber to be off the track. But the scrubber is so wide that if half the scrubber was off the track, it would be, like, blocking the symbols on either side of the scrubber.
All right. Anything else about iOS 26? Good deal. iPadOS 26. I freaking love it. It's not perfect. It's got problems. It's got lots of animation problems. It's got lots of rendering problems. I've had backboard D crashes. I've had springboard crashes. It's a mess. And I love it because for the first time, I really think that the iPad is starting to embrace what makes it good, which is to say kind of a macOS Lite. And that may sound insulting. I don't mean it that way at all. I am loving it. I don't think I said this on the show last week, but I saw somewhere somebody had tweeted at me and I can't recall where it was or who it was. But if you're on iPad, particularly on an 11-inch iPad like I am, somewhere in settings, I think in accessibility, you can change, or maybe it's in display, you can change to the more space option for the display, which basically cranks up the resolution ever so slightly and makes a world of difference on how much real estate you have to work with. So if you're playing around with iOS 26, especially on a smaller iPad, I strongly suggest doing that. Additionally, we're going to talk about this maybe a little bit later, but Stage Manager might be good. I don't know what to make of this. And this is an initial gut reaction, but I flipped on Stage Manager earlier today and I think it's not utter trash. And I'm really uncomfortable with that opinion, to be honest with you. But nevertheless, I am loving iPadOS 26. I am really looking forward to future betas when they get a lot of these rendering issues and springboard crashes and whatnot squared away, but absolutely loving it. And if you're someone who does not use your iPad as your primary computing device, then it's safe to upgrade. And honestly, even if you do use it as your primary computing device, it might be worth the upgrade because it's so good. But reading from John's prepared show notes, a friend of the show, Steve Trouton Smith, writes, if there's a limit to the number of open windows you can have on iPadOS 26, I haven't found it in the simulator yet. Exposé just keeps on going. And then later, oh, it's 12. The limit is 12 on an M4 iPad. Further windows get pushed into the recents carousel instead, but they return to the saved window sized when you tap them. I mean, I think 12 is pretty legit for a screen that is not terribly big. Sure, it could be more, but I think that's pretty reasonable.
Yeah, and I feel like that is like What's making that limit? How much? I keep getting this wrong, and I didn't look it up again. But how much RAM does the M4 iPad have?
I don't recall.
With the small start, like, look, this when we'll get to this when we talk about the press stuff. But like, talking about how iPads resource limits are why there was all these limitations on windowing. Like, in some respects, that makes sense, and they can, you know, cite historical precedent and where the iPad came from and how it has less RAM than Macs and still does, and, like, it makes sense, okay? But on the other hand, I would say you guys remember, take a guess at what the minimum RAM for macOS 10.10.0 was.
Oh, gosh, I don't even like want to think about it.
1 gig, maybe 512? I don't even know.
Casey, got anything?
It was what? Let me see, what year was this? It was, like,
2001.
Oh, boy. I'm going to say, I forget what RAM was, but I'm going to say maybe like 256 megs.
I think less than that. I think 64 megs, but gosh, that was so long ago. I don't know.
I'm going by memory. I don't think I put it in the notes. It was 128, I think.
All right.
Megabytes. Megabytes. Not 1 gigabyte, not 8 gigabytes, not 4 gigabytes, not 16 gigabytes, not 512 megabytes, 128 megabytes. And that was a complete windowing operating system with no limit on the number of windows you could have. And by the way, it had a compositing window manager, which was very new for the time. And it was software driven because it wasn't GPU accelerated at that point. And yeah, it was slow and everything. But the point is, macOS 10 in 2001 and 10.0 on a 128 meg machine did not limit the number of windows you had to have. And the resolution of screens then, maybe they weren't as high as an M4 iPad, but they weren't that low. And you could have a huge number. And I'm not saying that OS was doing the same things as the iPad is. But what I am saying is that if there are reasons for limitations for an M4 iPad Pro in terms of number of windows, I don't really accept RAM or CPU performance to be one of them. The M4 in that iPad is so much faster than every CPU in any Mac for decades running macOS 10 and has more RAM than almost all of them. The only reason that makes sense for limitations is, oh, it's a small screen, and that would be too cluttered. There were 12-inch, 11-inch Macs that also didn't have window limits. You could buy an 11-inch MacBook Air, and macOS didn't suddenly say you can only have 12 windows, right? So, they've made a big step here, but I think, and it's letting you use them, but I don't even know what he's talking about with the recents carousel. Like, I kind of understand why you might want to not open the floodgates and say unlimited windows, because people can get themselves into real trouble. And then one of the things that makes the iPad not the Mac is it is supposed to help people not get themselves into trouble. So I kind of get it. I don't really care that much about the 12 limit. It seems reasonable to me. I do have a little bit of pushback on anything having to say, well, it's because they don't use swap, or because they don't have enough RAM, or because, you know, the M4 is just so much more powerful. You put like 50 or 100 Macs back in the quote-unquote heyday of early macOS 10, they wouldn't be able to touch an M4. So, and again, I know they're not doing the same thing. I know things are much fancier now. I know they've got liquid glass. I know they've got all this other fancy stuff, but it's just, I hope they figure something out there, because even though 12 seems like a lot and it's plenty for our first run, I can imagine iPad power users wanting to have, especially with Stage Manager, which I'm not surprised that you like Stage Manager, Casey, because my understanding, again, I haven't even used this, just read about it. My understanding that essentially with the new windowing system is that Stage Manager has sort of become Spaces for iPad.
Basically, it's still got that sidebar situation on the left with like tilted thumbnails of
but you can hide
spaces.
That, can't you?
Well, this is the thing, and I think this is probably user error. I'm not necessarily saying that there's anything wrong with Stage Manager or the OS or anything like that, but it seems to be there sometimes and not be there sometimes. And I haven't cracked the code on when it shows up and when it hides. Again, probably a Casey issue, but it's very, very fickle, and I don't understand it. But yeah, yes.
On macOS, you can just straight up hide it. It's a setting. I don't know what it is. But anyway, like what it means is that in Stage Manager, you still have the full freedom of like rearranging the windows with the new windowing system on iPad OS 26. It's just that now there are different sets of them that you can rotate between. So it's kind of like Spaces for iPad OS.
And I am a devout user of Spaces on every platform. And so I was using the multitasking without slide. Or gosh, I keep saying Spaces and slide over. I was using the multitasking without Stage Manager for several days. And I do really, really like it. But I wanted to effectively have spaces, which is to say, you know, different virtual screens, if you will. And apparently the only way to really get that in iPadOS is with Stage Manager. And so just like I said earlier today, I flipped it on. And initial impressions are I like it. It does work well. It works way better than it did in prior versions of iPadOS. But it's still not clicked for me yet. And I'm hopeful that over time I will understand a little better what the ins and outs of it are. But I think I'm going to stick with it, at least for now. One thing I will say is that I was a moderate user of SlideOver on iPadOS, everything but 26. This is where you can slide from the extreme right-hand side of the screen, left a little bit, and you can put an app over there. So it's kind of like hanging out on top of everything else, but not, you know, not taking up too much space. And I use this from time to time, particularly for 1Password. That was a really convenient place to use it or way to use it. But it is dead in iPadOS 26, no matter how you slice it. SlideOver is gone. And I know a lot of people are very unhappy about this.
Yeah, I'm pretty unhappy too, because this is the one feature of the pre-iOS 26 sort of windowing stuff that I used a lot. And here's the thing, like, it would fit in perfectly with their windowing system, because SlideOver, the way they used to do it, is very limited. You got to go to the three-tab menu. You have to say, show this app and SlideOver. It goes to a specific spot. It gets a specific width. Like, it was very regimented before. But you can think of it as just like, this is just part of a window manager. I should be able to take literally any window of any size, bring it to any screen edge, and do a thing that says, hey, window, I want you to hide just off screen over there. And if I swipe in from the window edge, in the area where you're hiding, poke yourself back out. And then when I swipe you back in, hide yourself away. That's SlideOver. Like, you could do that you could do that on the Mac. It's a little bit harder because you can't, like, swipe from the screen edge. A little bit weird with the cursor. Like, on the iPad, you can literally go from, like, where the screen is not to where it is. So I get this is more touch-focused, but, like, that's just a window management feature of hide a window off-screen and have a gesture to make it come back on-screen and then go back off-screen. Any window, any size, any edge. I'm not saying they should do that. That's a lot, right? But what I'm saying is that SlideOver still fits in with the, like, the other option, the, like, it's like full screen apps, and the other option is, like, you know, this full screen app, Stage Manager, and, like, you know, do whatever you want with Windows. It fits in with the most pro, like, power user one. It also, I think, fits in with the everything full screen. Because you can have everything full screen and still have a single thing very limited in SlideOver, just like it was before. So it's kind of, I'm not quite sure why they got rid of it, because it seems to fit with everything they've done. Like, it's not like, well, they have this new system and SlideOver doesn't work at all. So I do hope they bring it back. I hope they bring it back somewhere. By the way, my main use case is full screen video that I'm watching, but social media timeline, if I'm watching some, like, reality TV show that I don't have to pay too much attention to, I get a two-screen experience on my one screen by swiping over and having, like, a Mastodon timeline while full screen video plays. And yes, I'm blocking part of the video, but it's like some dumb reality show, so who cares? So here's hoping SlideOver makes a comeback. If not this year, then maybe next.
All right. Hello, future Marco. I don't feel like we have too much to go, and even though we're running long, so I'm inclined, if we think we can power through it, to power through it.
Yeah, this is one quick dev item and one quick curiosity, and then we're done.
All right.
All right, testing Liquid Glass. In the Apple developer site, there's a link about UI design requires compatibility. And it reads, if yes, the system runs the app using a compatibility mode for UI elements. The compatibility mode displays the app as it looks when built against previous versions of the SDKs. So even if you're running on iOS 26 with this on, your app looks like it was built for iOS 18. But it was built for 26 and is running on 26. If no, the system uses the UI design of the running OS with no compatibility mode. Absence of the key or no is the default value for apps linking against the latest SDKs. Warning, temporarily use this key while reviewing and refining your app's UI for the design in the latest SDKs.
I think they might have even announced, like, next year this thing will no longer be honored. But yeah. The reason they have to have this in here is because it's not just that your stuff looks different. The metrics are different, meaning things are different width and height, and it will just blow up your layouts. If you didn't expect these buttons to be 2 pixels taller than they are, and this thing to be inset by this amount, like, it will break your layouts if you're not careful. And so they want to have a way. I mean, obviously, existing apps don't have this problem if you just don't recompile it because they're linking against the old SDK, which means they'll just look like they did. And they'll look ugly and won't fit in with the OS, and hopefully they'll be updated. But even if you want to use new features, you're built against the new SDK, you're using new features, but you don't have time to relay out every single view in your app, you can put this flag on to give yourself a little more breathing room until you can go in and, as we, not worst case scenario, but as we expected, when there's a big design change, you have to revisit every single screen in your app to make sure it still looks okay and to look at it to see if there's any place for improvement. This is before you even did the stuff that Marco was talking about, was like, well, maybe I need to redesign my app to fit in better with the OS. Just with your old design, the way it was, is all the text still readable? Do all the controls still fit on the screen? Can I see all the stuff that I expected to see? Is the layout broken in some way? This one key, if you're a developer, will save you from doing that work for a little bit longer.
Yeah, but ultimately, like, you're going to have to do it. I'm telling you. Yeah. Like,
or never update your app again. That's your other option.
Right.
Yeah, like, either way, like, you know, and you will start looking old very, very quickly starting this fall. So if you're wondering right now, should I redesign my app? The answer is yes. You definitely should redesign your app to handle all this stuff. The only question is, how quickly can you do it? So if it's going to take you a while, this might help you out. But don't make it take too long.
Yep. And then Steve Chan Smith found something interesting. He writes, Apple is now referring to the Vision Pro as Vision Pro 4K. In all of its developer tools, which suggests that there will be a new Vision Pro that's not 4K in the not too distant future. Interesting.
Weird. I mean, like, Apple TV 4K makes sense because it went from HD 1080 to 4K. As we've discussed many times in the past, when going to the minutiae of Vision Pro's displays, they're 4K-ish, but there's two of them. And does that mean it's 4K or is it 8K? The thing this makes me think about is, you know, as Steve points out very politically, there will be a new Vision Pro that is not 4K. Will it be less than 4K or
yeah.
more than 4K?
I mean, honestly, it needs both. Like, it needs there needs to be a cheaper Vision Pro. It also desperately needs more resolution than what it has.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say desperately, but your point is still fair.
I mean, there should definitely be one with more pixels, but I worry that less will take it outside the realm of, not viability, but, like, I do feel kind of like what they shipped is like a minimum viable resolution. So I know they need to make a cheaper one. I really hope they don't do it by sacrificing resolution, because it's like, at a certain point, the virtual Mac thing stops being useful when you start taking away pixels. Like, if you take away half or three quarters of the pixels, I don't know.
Well, but, like, okay, we heard rumblings and rumors and supply chain estimates that the little 4K screens inside the Vision Pro, the screens alone were like $1,500 worth of cost in the Vision Pro, and I don't know what that is today, but that was one thing we heard one time. Who knows if that's real? But regardless if it is or not, like, totally accurate, that tells you those screens certainly are very expensive, possibly the most expensive components in the Vision Pro. Now, you look at something like, you know, the Quest series of headsets, they're much lower resolution, but that entire headset can sell for a few hundred bucks. So, obviously, we're talking about a very different component price when you drop resolution. And if you want to make a cheaper Vision Pro, we can look at a lot of other ways to do it. Obviously, get rid of the stupid eye display on the outside. That's going to save some cost. Get, you know, maybe change some of the materials to be, you know, simpler, you know, maybe more plastic, which would save some weight and save some cost and be easier to work with. People who were, I remember, like, people were disassembling the Vision Pro when it first came out, and they had said, like, this is the most complex product ever produced, like, for the consumer-ish market. Like, it's so the manufacturing of it is so complicated. Maybe they can simplify things by simplifying certain shapes or giving uncertain, you know, design details. Does this thing have to be curved in a certain way? Maybe not. You know, so there's all sorts of ways that they can make a cheaper Vision Pro. But all of those might be very small savings relative to those damn little 4K postage stamps that are super expensive. So if they really want to cut this thing down in price, and they really, really need to, if what it takes is to go down to a resolution class that is closer or equal to what the Quest succeeds very well in having, okay, fine. Like, there's lots of use cases for the Vision Pro that don't need, like, super high-res everything. If what you're actually doing with it mostly is, like, watching movies or stuff like that, then who cares? Like, you can go much lower resolution for a lot of that stuff, and it's mostly doable, especially if that can cut the price down to, like, $1,000. But I think if you're going to have, if you want to have the price down that low, there's no way you do it without cutting the resolution right now.
I mean, I don't know how much those screens cost. I heard that they were switching from Sony to a different vendor. I think maybe LG or Samsung or somebody. So Sony is not known for its low price, but, you know, the volumes are still not great. So I don't know. The thing I have a problem is, like, you know, like the Apple TV. Are you going to go to 1080? No, that's like those, what are those glasses that you wear? Those like sunglass type things. Like, that's like 1080 is too little, I feel like. But, you know, if that's like, if the price really hasn't come down, we'll see. Anyway, I'm hoping that they're calling it 4K because the next one will be like 6K or something. And I really hope they don't go below that, but we shall see.
I, for one, am looking forward to the Vision Amateur. All right. Are we done?
We sure I are. Hope so. All right. Let me pull up. Okay. All right. Thank you to our sponsors this week, HelloFresh and Squarespace. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the perks of membership is ATP Overtime, our weekly bonus topic. This week in Overtime, we're talking about how Apple did press interviews for this WWDC. You know, they didn't do the talk show. They did a whole bunch of other interviews. We're going to talk about that, kind of what they said, why they did what they did, etc. That's going to be an Overtime this week. Thank you so much to everybody for listening. You can join if you want to hear Overtime at atp.fm/join, and we'll talk to you next week.
So, John, I did not follow directions because you were not explicit in your directions.
I was very explicit.
Sorry, I knew you were going to jump on me as soon as I said that out loud. Let me rephrase. You were not explicit in your written directions in the internal show notes. All it says is favorite things from WWDC 2025, of which I came up with a list of like 10 items. But then you reminded me that you had asked for N items.
In my spoken directions.
Yes, yes.
Should be easier to remember. And by the way, the reason it's plural is because there's three of us. So if we each bring one item, that would be three items.
That is fair. John, would you like to go first? What is your favorite thing?
No, I want you to go first because you did the most homework here.
Oh, all right. Well,
so rank them. Pick your favorite one, then we'll go to Marco, then we'll go to me.
All right. I think my favorite is the new iPadOS stuff, including Stage Manager, as just discussed a moment ago. But since we already talked about that, I'm gonna claim that is already covered. I gotta tell you, I don't know if it's my favorite, but it does jump out at me amongst things that I've actually tried so far, because I have a list of things that I think I will really enjoy, but I haven't tried them yet. Amongst the things I've actually tried, one of the few things I've done with the new Vision OS is create a new persona. If you recall, the persona is how they represent you when you're on like a FaceTime call, because your face has a huge freaking set of goggles in front of it. And the very first version was real bad and real deep in the uncanny valley. Then they revamped it and it got pretty good. I mean, if you're leaving aside the fact that Mike's, you know, beard prevents him from opening his mouth as he's talking, it was pretty good. And in VisionOS 26, they have redone it yet again. And I got on a call with Jason Snell a couple yesterday for a little bit. And I got to tell you, these things look real good. We have very much come out of the uncanny valley and we are back onto one of the peaks because they look incredible. So if you happen to be a person that either has a Vision Pro in your life or knows someone with a Vision Pro, ask them, you know, once they get the new OS or put the beta on, you know, or whatever, you know, set up a new persona and get on a FaceTime call with them. It is very surprising how good it looks. And one of the greatest advantages is the original personas, they were basically, they weren't literally flat, but they were kind of effectively flat. You only really looked at the front of your face, and they would have you look up a little bit and down a little bit so they could kind of at least give the indication of you, for example, nodding or whatever the case may be. But now they capture or perhaps just process a lot more of your head. So you can actually look to the side and your entire head is there rather than it just kind of fading out like Back to the Future style. It's really, really good. And amongst the things I've experienced, that's probably my favorite so far. All right. I think we said you wanted Marco next and you'll finish up. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. All right. My favorites so far. Transcription. The transcription
API. Oh, good.
API.
Have you played with it?
Of course I have. It's the very first thing I did.
Sorry. What I meant to say is, have you reached conclusions so far, even tentative conclusions?
Tentatively. I haven't tested it on a huge variety of input audio yet. But so far, the transcription API seems very fast and good enough. Like, it's not like as good as like the biggest, most aggressive server-side models, but it runs on my phone for free really fast. And it's very close to the quality of the best models in my testing so far. So that's amazing. And this will allow me to build some cool stuff. It's not, you know, I'm not going to be able to build everything perfectly, doing it constantly, because that would just be too much power. But I can do a lot with this. A lot. And I'm very, very happy about that.
That's super exciting. Genuinely, I hope I don't sound sarcastic, because that's really, really cool. I don't know if you saw, but John Voorhees did a write-up about it.
Mm-hmm.
And his son, I think it was Finn, forgive me if it wasn't Finn, but one of his sons put together a open source command line wrapper around the new APIs, YAP. And so you can play with that if you want. I haven't had the chance to play with this yet. One of the things I think all three of us want to do at some point is to provide transcripts for our episodes. And there were two major reasons why, at least I didn't want to yet. Number one, it was a pain in the butt and took forever to do. And number two, nothing that I'm aware of does speaker
Whisper differentiation.
Oh, does it? Okay. Yeah. I didn't realize
Descript,
that.
Descript or Descript or however you pronounce it has also done it for a while, but it's not as easy to hook into that as it is to Whisper. But I'm in the same camp that speaker recognition is like essential. Like, it's, mm-hmm. like without that, as you know, I know we have, there's a bunch of like fans have made really cool search sites that to like find the episode where somebody said blah, but for an actual transcript, you really need to know who's speaking. So I've just been waiting patiently for that technology to get to the point where it's really reliable, because I think, as we've discussed in past episodes, I think all of our voices are very distinct and computers should be able to tell us apart.
Yeah.
Obviously transcribing a show like this with where we have lots of, proper nouns and weird programming terms may be challenging, but I feel like we'll get there eventually. But as of pre-WWDC, I feel like the technology / cost benefit analysis wasn't quite there. But as Marco points out, well, what if everyone just has it on their phone for free? That really changes the equation.
It really does. And also, and I haven't yet gotten too much of a chance to play with the on-device LLM either. But from the little bit I have seen from sessions and from early reports from other people, the on-device LLM is also no joke. It's really, really good for a lot of things. Not everything. This is still a model that runs on your phone. So it's not going to be as good as like the flagship models that run in giant data centers on these giant NVIDIA things. But for it running on your phone, locally, offline, for free, that's a lot of big advantages. And there's a lot you can do.
I'd like to build on that just a teeny bit. I think most of the people listening to this show probably know exactly what you're talking about. But the thing of it is that if I wanted to do some trick, you know, LLM based stuff, to do some processing in call sheet, that would require something that, you know, like an LLM. If I were to do that today, then what I would need to do is communicate something across the network and make a request to like ChatGPT's API or something like that, which has a non-zero cost, and you spread that across all your users, and that can really start to add up fast. And additionally, you're going across the network, so it's not going to be as fast as it would be if it was on your device. There's a lot of reasons why this becomes cumbersome to do today. But by virtue of this speech framework for transcription stuff, and then what's the name of the framework? A foundation framework or foundation model framework? Thank you. By virtue of having that on device, that means that a lot of the reasons that I would have not to do this go away because of what Marco was just describing. You know, it's effectively free. It's on the device. You know, it doesn't require me to pay any more money. It doesn't require a network request, generally speaking. So a lot of the things that I felt kind of handcuffed me have now gone away. Now, in the case of CallSheet, I'm not sure if I'm ever going to use this. I'm noodling through a couple of ideas here and there, but the fact that this is possible, and to build on what Marco said again, my understanding is it's actually a pretty good system. You know, it's not perfect, like Marco said, but it's pretty robust. That is very exciting. And even if CallSheet doesn't use it very heavily, or even if Overcast doesn't use it very heavily, which that is not what Marco said. I'm just, you know, putting words in his mouth now. Even if we don't, there's a lot of, even if we are not the ones that are leveraging it, there's a lot of apps that will. And that's really, really exciting.
Yeah. And I think there's going to be like one of the really cool things they did was this generable macro where as the app developer, you don't have to say like, please output valid JSON and then, you know, try to decode it. No, they actually like they allow you to annotate like your custom data structures in your app, and you can describe what each field needs and means in the data structure. And then you could say, generate these as the output of whatever prompt you're giving it.
That is super slick.
So if it like properly fills out your data structures based on how you're describing what their different fields mean. That's really cool. And so I think what we're going to see is a lot of apps using this for all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really exciting. And I go back and forth about my opinions on AI and LLMs and whatnot, but this to me is almost entirely upside, and I'm really looking forward to thinking about how I can leverage it and to see how others are leveraging it. And another example of this is, and I don't know if I think I might have brought this up last week, and I don't know if I'll be able to find the tweet, but Ryan Ashcraft from Foodnoms, which I think sponsored once maybe back in the day, but is certainly a great app, was using this to like come up with an example icon for a food that you create or something like that. And that's so silly, but it's so nice and it makes things just a touch better. And that's a great example of a little place that you might not even realize is using, you know, this new onboard LLM technology, and yet it'll make Foodnoms just a touch better. And that's pretty great. All right. Anything else from you, Marco, at this particular moment? We might come back around. We'll see. But all right, John, what is your one and only one, John, favorite?
Yeah, so I thought this would be a good after show just because I knew that most of the main show was going to be all these weird issues and things that we've learned about the OS. So let's pick our favorite things. I didn't think this would be a big challenge for me. But then when I thought about it, like, oh, I should come up with a favorite thing for myself. It's not that I didn't like things at WWDC, but there's no one thing that stands out a lot as my big favorite thing. And there's a lot of stuff, like, when I've gone through all the sessions, this is not a year, this, you know, every developer is different, but this is not a year where I see something like, oh, I wanted that API forever. Marco was in that camp this year with the transcription. That happens, you know, like, the last time I remember it happening is obviously not as important as the transcription thing Marco's talking about, but it was the rounded rectangle with uneven rounding on the corners from like 2 years ago. So I could make switch class with corners that aren't rounded at screen edges, which is the thing I wanted to do, but I couldn't do unless I totally took over custom drawing and I didn't want to bother with them. Like, oh, Apple will probably eventually do this. And they did. And I was so happy. Nothing like that for me this year. Everything that I've seen, even when I think it's going to be something that I can use, I try it and I just find the bugs in it and I find out it doesn't work for me. And then I file the feedbacks and I just go back to my old code. And like I said, all of my apps need to be updated. I mean, all of them, like they were not that they weren't shippable, but I would never want any of my users to use my apps the way they looked recompiled with the new SDK on Tahoe. So I'm in there doing a lot of work, and I do actually enjoy working on my apps. And in that, some ways, it's kind of fun to have a project because I'm not adding features. I'm just sort of making sure they're all updated with the new design and look reasonable, at least. I guess if I had to pick in that work that I'm doing, sort of, you know, my one favorite thing is like getting to work on all my apps and updating them, because I am actually like finding issues and bugs. That's another fun thing, especially like in Hyperspace, which is an app that only ever shipped on one OS because it requires Mac OS 15. That's the only OS it has ever run on. Suddenly my app is running on two OSs, 15 and 26. And it just takes one more different version to find a bunch of little bugs that are like, oh yeah, I didn't notice that bug because it works fine in 15, but it actually was a bug in my code. And now that I see it running on 26, it behaves a little bit differently and I can fix it. So I'm actually improving my apps. But as you might imagine or might not have thought about, but I certainly did the second I started hearing about this redesign, I have an app called Switch Glass that puts a transparent glass thing with apps in it on your screen. I'm going to use the glass texture as one of the options. It's already configurable with a bunch of deprecated constants that Apple doesn't want me to use, but I put in the pop-up menu because they look cool. Guess what? There's a new item called glass. Although I am, again, tinged with strange disappointment. if you watch the sessions, you know, okay, there's two kinds of glass, though. There's the regular glass, and there's the clear glass. And clear glasses, they have some mumbo-jumbo where it's appropriate. Like, they show it on, like, video player controls. It's fine for clear glass to be video player controls because it's totally illegible, but whatever. You can still see them. They're huge. But don't use it anywhere else because clear glass is super clear. But I'm like, all right, well, fine. I'll put in an option on my pop-up menu for regular glass and clear glass. But I think on macOS, clear glass doesn't exist. It's just glass. You don't get to use the clear kind, which is kind of disappointing. So, and I guess maybe the other random thing in there, like my one item is like, I can't find a favorite. There's no big standout. But my other one is like Swift 6.2, which I've, you know, Swift is developed in the open. If you want to follow it for the entire year, you can. You'll know exactly what's going to launch in WWDC because it's developed in the open. It's like literally open source. You can download it. But you don't get to use that in Xcode until Apple ships it. And now 6.2 is available in Xcode. 6.2 has lots of features that make strict concurrency a lot nicer. Mm-hmm. 6.2 fixed some concurrency bugs that were in 6 and 6.1, which caused my code not to compile anymore. But hey, those were bugs in my code before that now I get to fix. So yeah, my one item is that there is no big item for me, but it's not because I'm sad about anything. It's because this is not a year where there's something that's rocking my world from WWDC. It's mostly just I get to update all my apps, which is fun to work in a new design, and the language gets updated and yada yada. I wish I was more enthusiastic about the look and feel of Tahoe. Like I said, the best I can say about it is that using it, it's not like the end of the world. It's fine, right? It's just not my favorite. I mean, I've been through this before. There's lots of versions of Mac OS X that were not my favorite looks-wise, and they come and go and get refined and changed. So right now I'm beta 1. I'm not that big of a fan, but I'm actually surprised myself at how much of a non-event it is for me to be using literally every day this week Tahoe, like basically all day, and it just seems normal to me. So I don't know. I've obviously not followed my own rules with my single favorite, but I really feel like my one thing is like I can't pick a favorite. And it's not because WWDC was bad, it's just because of where I am with my apps. That's it.
Yeah, the revamp of Swift concurrency or strict concurrency or whatever, I am really amped about that because to oversimplify, and I'm probably going to get a couple of the technical facts wrong, but the general gist is it used to assume once you started using like async await that, oh, everything in this app could be on any thread and on any actor. You'll never know where it's running. And so you have to super protect everything. And now there's a new default, which you can opt into for an older app that says, hey, just assume everything is running on the main thread and explicitly state when it isn't going to be. And again, I'm oversimplifying a little bit, but that's a general gist. And that should make adopting strict concurrency so much easier because I continued to kick that can down the road. And I am kind of glad I did. This is a case of the Marco patented procrastination for the win sort of situation where, you know, I probably shouldn't have waited this long, but hey man, it's worked out great. So that is on the list of things to do this summer is to properly embrace that.
That's not even the thing that I'm talking about though, because I'm already on Swift strict concurrency. Yeah, and yeah. Actually that mode isn't particularly useful to me. It's all the other stuff of like, hey, strict concurrency used to complain about this because it couldn't figure out that it was actually safe, but now it can. And Apple annotating all its APIs. Cause if I just wrote a Swift 6 app in isolation with none of Apple's APIs, it's pretty easy to do. But you've got to use API. You got to use APIs for the platform to actually make an app. And those APIs, where some of them are written in the 90s, like they're not all properly annotated, or if they are properly annotated, they're annotated in a way that makes your life miserable because things are not like this is non-isolated and you can't change the fact that it's non-isolated, but you have to hop onto a different actor to do the thing that you want. And it's just, there's lots of places where you're like, oh, I really have to ug up my code here to make this work because there's no async await version of this. It's a callback based API. The callback is non-isolated, but I have to access data that's confined to either an actor or a main actor or one of my own actors. And I can't even get at that data from the non-isolated thing without hopping actors, but it has to do it synchronously. But this is not an async function, so I can't await it. And it's just that stuff. As Apple updates its APIs and as Apple improves Swift to be able to be smarter about figuring out when something is actually safe, that's the thing that makes my life easier. And again, my hypertext is already Swift 6 strict concurrency. Like it has been from day 5, maybe. So it's not a big deal for me, but it did actually find bugs in my code by fixing bugs in Swift concurrency that used to allow me to do things that were technically unsafe. So thumbs up all around. Like DevTools. Like, and the thing is, I'm doing this on an Intel Mac. I don't even get to see or use the new like LLM things. I think I should be able to use the ChatGPT one, but it wasn't working for me. It might be a beta bug, but I'm not even benefiting from all that stuff because it's ARM only, right? Just Xcode with the new SDK and the, you know, the new version of Swift and Apple's updated APIs. I've been enjoying doing development for the past week.
Good.
All right. Shall we do titles?
Yes, please.
Got here. I may have to take my dog out before we do overtime.
Oh, Hop's not happy?
Yeah, he's been... Tiff's out of town tonight, and he's been crying a lot over the last few minutes at the door.
It's been a big Daisy night, I'm sure you've heard her.
Yes. Oh, yeah, I did hear. Which is very unusual for Daisy, at least.
Well, because there's no one to watch her here either.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I don't dislike There's No Bar, which is the current leader. I really liked Naked Robotic. All right.
Time has passed. I mean, we didn't use it as a title, but it was said then.
Let's see. You Have to Invert. I like that.
That is pretty good.
Milk Glass is okay.
Yeah, I kind of like You Have to Invert. Let me see. There was a couple of good ones. We had a lot of good titles this week. I saw them go by. Well, I saw them go by as in I heard them. I'm not sure if people recommended them. Let's see.
Petty Feedbacks I suggested and I really liked. I thought that
I
was
good.
I need
to file more Petty Feedbacks. The fun thing is that after I get that kernel panic every time I try to boot into Tahoe, it prompts me for like the, you know, report this to Apple, and it literally makes a feedback that appears as submitted by me in the feedback app. I'm like, all right, I mean, then the, like, what happened? It says, I booted.
Cool.
I restarted my computer. So it's such a weird, like, you think it would kernel panic and never boot, but no, it always does it on the second or third try. I'm just like, all right, well, it's going to be like that.
All right, let's do. I'm a big. My number one is You Have to Invert of these.
Yeah, I think so too. Okay. I think that's it.
Done and done.
All right, I have to go take my dog out. So excuse me for 5 minutes.
Okay.
Enjoy doing your own show without me.
That's fine. And in future episode, in probably next week or sometime in the future, I'm going to talk about my icon journey. Casey, have you started on your icon? You probably haven't started on your icon.
No. Jelly sent me a cut of the OG icon, the one that the
clapperboard. You're outsourcing your icon journey.
Mm-hmm. The clapperboard icon. He sent me a cut of that, which looked good and had depth and like layers to it. But I fear, and I told him this, I fear that it's a little too complicated, especially since all of the system apps seem to have been not dumbed down. That's kind of demeaning and not
simplified.
Really what I mean, but simplified. Yeah, that's a better way of putting it. Since all those have been simplified pretty aggressively, I wonder if I should do something similar. So I've talked to Jelly about this, and I haven't really done anything personally with it. Additionally, I've talked to Steve, who did basically everything but the OG icon, about what to do. And he also knows that we need to chat about it at some point, but you know, because we've only had a cursory conversation about it, but we've both been slammed. And so I haven't had a chance to do much. Unrelated to icon stuff, and I know we're still live, but while I'm thinking of it, there were a couple more screenshots that I'm going to need you to pull or regenerate, please, and put in the show notes.
Regenerate.
Well, what, I don't know if you saved them off or whatever, but anyways, But the point is, you'll see your name bolded and in all caps in the show notes. It doesn't have to be right this minute, but just as an FYI, please go ahead.
Yeah, by the way, one of the we all float down here. That was a link. I meant you to put that link in the notes. Okay, I'm just making sure because you said, is that a reference? You would know.
But yeah, I was playing dumb for the crowd, John.
All right, I just want to know.
Because I clicked it during my research time
all
this
right,
morning.
All right. Let's tell me which screenshots you're missing. I don't know how the things in front of me. Just tell me which ones.
Let me see.
Ugly Safari one? The tab?
Terminal tabs and Ugly Safari and the two left-aligned title bar. Oh, no, wait. No, you did give me that, didn't you? Shoot.
I gave you that one.
No, hold on. No. It was the... Let me scroll back to where it is. Hold on. Where did that go? Yes. You gave me the left-aligned text. You did not give me the two for the left-aligned title bar. That was the one I was missing.
Let's see. Let's do Ugly Safari first. There's that. And then...
This is all your problem now, for the record. The show notes are available for you to edit.
Yeah.
The chat room is disappointed with our vamping, which is funny because we're supposed to be hanging up on them anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have any more Switch 2 talk you'd like to share?
I'll save that for the actual show.
Oh, all right. How about this? Hot take on the Bungie and I almost said Mastodon, Marathon news of earlier today.
Oh, the delay? Everyone knows it's going to be delayed. It's fine. It should be delayed. It's not done yet. It needs more work.
Well, okay, I'm back. Hi.
Oh, that was fast. Is Hop satisfied now?
Probably not, but we'll see.
All right.
Probably at least satisfied enough to get through 20 minutes of overtime.
Fair enough. All right. I think we're cutting off the live people now, then?
Yes. Bye, live people. Okay. Thank you for listening.
Next week, we're still Wednesday, and then after that, it gets gross, right?
Yes. Then summer happens, and everything gets thrown out the window.
Yep. All right. Goodbye, live people. We'll see you in a week.